This is Matt Demmer of Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury telling you that there is no better time to buy a vehicle than right now. During the Lincoln Mercury Signature Sales Event, simply sign and drive away. Zero first month's payment.
Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
Back surgery, weight loss surgery, cardiac care, incredibly complex medicine made easy to understand, thanks to the DMC. Join Emory King at DMC.org to see why, when it's serious, go to Detroit. Check out the DMC videos today at DMC.org.
Award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Hey, thank you very much. Welcome to the broadcast. A pleasure to be here with you, joining me in the WRIF studios, as usual, Jalene Jordan. Hi, Jalene.
Hi, good to be here, as always.
As always, yeah. What a week, but every week is... What a week, isn't it?
Yeah, well, things just keep getting worse. Oh. I mean, not to start off on a negative note or anything.
That's right. You know, I was thinking, I was reading this column in the New York Times by Bob Herbert about the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, the guy who was the pastor of Barack Obama, and all these things he said. Everyone was so shocked and horrified. And it occurred to me that I've never seen any footage of him, never heard a thing that he said. And that's one of the things that's nice about not watching very much television.
Right.
You don't get inundated by this crap. What's the difference what Reverend Jeremiah Wright said? You know what I thought, and I don't know everything that Jeremiah Wright said, but in general, I suspect that about 80% of what he says is correct.
Well, here's the one thing that I think sent everyone over the edge, and that is that he said that the government created AIDS to kill black people.
That's true.
That's what he said.
That's true.
Is it true?
No, that's in the 20% of the...
Wait a minute.
The cuckamamie things. That's not true.
That is pretty crazy.
Yeah. On the other hand, it's sort of symptomatic. A number of people have made this point. It's symptomatic how many people within the African-American community are so alienated from the government and think they're capable of anything. It's much like, think about this segment of the so-called white community that thinks that George Bush and Dick Cheney directly ordered the 9/11 strike.
Oh, yeah,
yeah.
Definitely.
No, I know you're going to think I'm part of the cover-up because I'm not saying that they did it. So people believe a lot of crazy things, but when they do, I'm trying to think of the name of this book. It's something under and the madness of crowds. So it's not just that people believe things that are wrong or crazy or observably incorrect. The real question to me is why do people believe that? Like,
yeah.
Every history book, every American history book, and every official commentator says that Lee Harvey Oswald was this lone assassin of John F. Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that happened a long time ago. I can't do the math here. What is it? 45 years ago?
Yeah,
45 years ago. So the vast majority of American people weren't even alive. Or the majority of people, I don't know, the vast majority. And yet, something like 80% of the American people do not believe that it was a conspiracy.
Right.
I mean, I don't know what it was, but I know it didn't happen the way they say it.
Well, I think it all comes down to the fact that so many people are really the sheeple.
Yes. Well, here's what I think. A lot of people that aren't sheeple
Right.
Yeah. Like Jeremiah Wright, and there's people, there's other African-American preachers, people like in Detroit, let me see, Reverend Albert Clegg, people like that, that they are about, I don't know, they are right about three-quarters of the time.
Well, and you know, this may be controversial, and you already said it, but I said this to someone I was having a conversation about Reverend Wright as well, and that, you know, some of the things I've heard, I agree with.
Sure.
Well, I agree with.
I know. I think most of us would. So then, let me see. Then I would say, like, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, what they say is correct or the truth or right on the money in terms of what we need to figure out. They're right about 50% of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the rest then you of got hot air.
Yeah. And then you got John McCain, maybe 12%.
Maybe.
And then Bush, zero.
Right.
I mean,
exactly.
If he says it's Sunday, I'm going... Wow. Let me look at the calendar. But all right. But there was some news. So what's the importance of all that? What's the importance? Because Frank Rich in today's New York Times made the point that there's this absolutely insane far right wing bigot, this Reverend Hagee, whose endorsement McCain sought.
Oh.
That thinks that the Catholics are the Antichrist and tons of absolutely insane stuff.
Don't you think that? I kid, I tease.
Well, when you go, I actually saw on this website, he Reverend Hagee, this right-wing fundamentalist, who's all about the final days and the Antichrist and all that.
Okay.
And he's talking about the horror of Babylon. You know, they're really big about the horror of Babylon. Yeah.
Wow.
I am the horror of Babylon. I mean, you know, they're such sick puppies.
Yeah.
But so he's got this kind of fleshy, sexy woman. This is, what do they call it?
I can't remember. Fleshy. I like that.
Well, yeah. He's got this diorama. Is that the word? He's got this whole scene that he's got this pointer, and the whore of Babylon is riding some mythical beast, and he keeps poking her with the...
Okay, what's the hidden meaning?
Oh, man, there's nothing hidden with these sick boys.
That's true. Well, it's they've repressed themselves.
They have. But the big story was, and I tried this on a number of my very politically aware people. I said, do you know there was a general strike today? This was, Thursday, May 1st. And they said, huh?
Is this the actors?
No. Well, this is what I mean. That the International Longshore and Warehouse Union.
Oh, I did hear this on news.
On what? What news?
On NPR.
Really?
Yeah.
Someone said they hadn't heard it on that as well. 10,000 workers went on a one-day general strike to protest the war in Iraq all over the West Coast. All the ports were shut from San Diego to to Seattle, including Los Angeles. Yeah. McElrath, the ILWU's international president, said, we're loyal to America and we won't stand by while our country, our troops, and our economy are destroyed by a war.
Wow.
Cargo traffic came to a halt. Workers stayed off the job for about 10 hours. Thousands of dock workers at 29 ports in California, Oregon, and Washington were no-shows for the morning shift. Longshore workers in San Francisco and Seattle joined rallies with other anti-war protesters.
This is huge.
This is totally huge.
And this is the kind of thing we are talking about.
And in the New York Times, the paper of record, all the news that's fit to print, it was on page 19, and they said longshoremen joined with something like self-identified socialist.
Really?
Ooh, yeah.
Right. Did they really go there?
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Wasn't there supposed to be another something at the ports?
That was it. That's it.
That's the one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and then there's supposed to be something about the gas strike as well. So that's good. So direct action of that sort is what will move politicians. Will, in fact, if it began to be generalized into a generalized general strike, that's how this war could end. The vast majority of American people are opposed to this war, know that it's lost for all practical purposes, that it's a slaughter. What I didn't even want to go right into that. Again, four Marines killed in Iraq's Anbar province. That was the region that was supposed to be calm because the Sunni groups had become, you know, we paid them off, essentially.
Right.
We're paying tens of thousands of these guys $200 a month out of our tax dollars.
And who knows about that, really? When do you hear that talked about in the mainstream media? You don't.
You know, there's always this debate. I was listening to this, some jerk off. can I say that?
Tell us what you really feel.
Right wing conservative on a local station. And, you know, these conservatives, they really, one of the themes that they keep hitting are two things. That conservative women are better looking than liberal women.
Oh, I don't believe that at all. I don't buy it. Are you serious?
They're always on about that.
That is so dumb.
Like, what's that woman, that right-wing ninny on...
Ann Coulter?
No.
Elizabeth Hasselbeck on The View.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
God.
So, they're always talking about her compared to, like, Rosie.
Oh, please.
Yeah, that was their deal.
Come on.
Right.
But they can have her. Really?
But
welcome to her.
And the other thing is that they're always talking about how unhappy liberals are and how happy and good-hearted people conservatives are.
Well, okay. Well, I have to go on record to say this is one happy liberal right here. And I know you are, too.
I'm not a liberal.
Oh, yeah. We're way far left
We're far left. But, you know, I haven't talked about this in a long time, but some of you have heard it, so I'll go by it real quickly. But the conservatives have been on the wrong side of every issue of American history. Remember, they opposed the revolution to begin with. They were for slavery. They were against women's vote. They were against the labor movement. They were for segregation. I know they were Democrats in that regard. And they were against every single movement for reform, for extension of American democracy. They were for prohibition. They're the mainstay of prohibition against drugs, you know, the war on drugs and all that. So they're wrong about everything all the time. But I don't know how they can keep coming back. I mean, I would be embarrassed. Once in a while, when I've made mistakes, I'll admit to it. And there's some things that I wrote in the past that I was talking about the future. So it was, you can make mistakes. Like, sort of. I mean, it's kind of a long story. It's not even worth it.
All right.
But fairness and accuracy in reporting. Fair.org, they had this release called "The Final Word is Hooray, Remembering the Iraq War's Pollyanna Pundits." And what that means is that, remember, it was the media, including the New York Times, including National Public Radio, that we called Nationalistic Pentagon Radio at the time. And here, they just assembled some of the stuff. Actually, it's 7 pages long of quotes, but Los Angeles Times, this is April 10th, 2003. Iraq is all but one, or is something else?
Yeah.
Chris Matthews on MSNBC. We're all neoconservatives now.
Oh, please.
Newsweek's, and this again, that's...
he's changed his mind.
April 03. Well, yeah. They know, they don't, what Bob Dylan said, you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows.
Yeah, really.
Blowing up their butt.
Yeah.
Howard Feynman of Newsweek back in May of 03 said, we had controversial wars that divided the country. This war united the country and brought the military back. Charles Krautheimer from Inside Washington, the only people who think this wasn't a victory in Iraq are the Upper West Side liberals and a few people here in Washington. Then they did the mission accomplished thing, right? And PBS's Gwen Ifill says, the war winds down, politic heats up, picture perfect, part Spider-Man, part Tom Cruise, part Ronald Reagan. She's talking about Bush saying mission accomplished on the battleship.
I remember that.
The president seizes the moment on an aircraft carrier in the Pacific.
That was just out of hand.
More Chris Matthews on MSNBC. May 5 years ago. We're proud of our president. Americans love having a guy as president. A guy who has a little swagger, who's physical, who's not a complicated guy. They want a guy who's president. Women like a guy who's president. Check it out. Women like this war. I think we like having a hero as our president. It's simple. We're not like the Brits, whatever the hell that is.
You know, I bet he's cringing now.
Yeah. Lou Dobbs said, Bush looked like an alternatively like commander in chief, rock star, movie star, and one of the guys.
Please give me a break. I'm not a fan of the Lou Dobbs. Not at all.
No, the guy's an idiot.
He really is awful.
Yeah. Then they really came down hard on the millions of us that were opposed to the war right from the beginning. And mm-hmm. Alan Colmes, who is the conservatives' favorite liberal.
Alan Colmes,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. On Fox, he said, now that the war in Iraq is all but over, this is April of 2003, should the people in Hollywood who oppose the president admit they were wrong? Joe Scarborough on MSNBC, I doubt that the journalists at the New York Times and NPR at ABC or at CNN are ever going to admit just how wrong their negative pronouncements were over the past 4 weeks.
Can you believe this? Amazing what a difference 5 years makes.
Yeah.
Five years it took them.
Dick Morris on Fox said, over the next couple of weeks, when we find the chemical weapons this guy was amassing, the fact that this war was attacked by the left and so the right was so vindicated, I think, really means the left is going to have to hang its head for 3 or 4 more years.
Yeah, right. We're really hanging it.
Yeah.
He's a real whack job, too, that
yeah,
Dick Morris.
Bill O'Reilly. Here's three from Bill O'Reilly.
Oh, I can barely take it.
January 2003. This is before the war. These are all before the war. I'll bet you the best dinner in the Gaslight District of San Diego that military action will not last for more than a week.
What?
Yeah. Are you willing to take that wager? He said on Fox. Then another month later, he said, it won't take weeks. You know that, professor, he's talking. Our military machine will crush Iraq in a matter of days, and there's no question that it will.
Yeah, see, that's what he does to get suck people in,
yeah.
Is he tells them, this is how it is. And it's completely wrong.
He says, once the United States and Britain unleash, it's maybe ours. They're going to fold like that. So these are the conservatives, and they're absolutely shameless.
Yeah, completely shameless. I saw a display. I watched a little bit of him last week when he interviewed Hillary. And she was actually, Peter, laughing at him. it was like a parody on Saturday Night Live.
Like laughing at him?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, definitely. I loved it.
Well, I don't know if I would be so catastrophically incorrect, wrong, and after having been so assured that I don't know if I would have the whatever to continue in this profession.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, there were times.
That's because you have a conscience.
Yeah.
That's the difference between you and these guys.
When the United States just rolled over the Iraqi army, I didn't think they had much of an army, so that didn't surprise me. And I had no idea what this was all going to take or what it was all about, so I wasn't making any pronouncement. But these guys. And so dead wrong on everything. And conservatives have been dead wrong since the origins of this country. Why do they have any following other than a few whack jobs?
And so much power.
Well, that's it. I think they've accrued power. And there are people that authoritarian personalities love people in power.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, people loved Hitler. People loved Stalin.
Right.
More good news,
point.
I guess. The checks are in the mail.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to get one, huh?
I guess.
So my wife doesn't work. Do I get $600? Or it says, the plan provides rebates of up to $600 for individuals and up to $1,200 for couples filing jointly.
Yeah, you have to be married, which, once again, the...
the discrimination.
The privilege continues.
Yeah, yeah. So,
sorry.
Yeah.
Just because I'm not married anymore doesn't mean you can't reap the benefits.
So I don't know. So I'll just find out. Well, that's a better idea. Spend $168 billion giving us back some money that we never should have paid in the first place.
Right.
Because it's being wasted on a war on drugs and a war on terror. That's just more for the military industrial complex. So I was thinking, what I was going to do, I was going to be a good American, and I was going to spend it.
Right.
Yeah, because, we live in a house with old windows, or it's all, it's wood. And so the frame around is beginning to deteriorate. I need new storms and all that. And new windows, whole new windows. I mean,
that's expensive.
Yeah, but if you can get these storm and screen units to put in there, I mean, that's what's in there now, except they're wood. I thought, okay. I'll go spend it. I'll do that. But then I thought maybe I would spend it on gasoline instead.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. And, did you send me that article about milk? No, that was today. The price of milk, everything is getting so scary, you know, food prices and everything like that. We don't drink it. I don't drink it. You don't drink it. But the price of a gallon of milk is expected to go up to $4.
Well, I have to say, I don't know.
It used to be like $1.69 or something like that, you know. So everything is increasing. Yeah, except, wages.
Yes.
Right.
I knew there was something. Remember, we've talked about this in the past. When any store is advertising milk, they always put on it, homo milk. What is up with that?
You would think some people would be so afraid of that.
Yeah, I know. I mean, all milk is homogenized, right?
I think so.
Yeah, it all is. Yeah, but they don't put like pasto, like to make it pasteurized.
Right.
Everything's, all milk is pasteurized.
Yeah.
It has to be.
Yeah.
So it's pasteurized and homogenized.
Thanks for telling us.
So it might be like they could put pat hum or something like that, but it says homo milk.
Now I'm going to pay attention.
You think this could be part of the homosexual agenda?
It could be.
Did you notice that too? That whenever these right wing freaks talk about gays, they call them the gays. Well, no, people don't use the word homosexual very much anymore.
No, you're just gay.
Yeah.
I think.
But at least they used to. They would say. Instead of saying homosexual, say homosexual.
Those homosexuals.
Yeah.
And it's more like sexual.
And how do the Brits say it? Homosexual.
They do.
Something like that. I don't know.
Interesting. We get off track so easily.
Pete. Yeah. This is, all right.
This is all too interesting, but.
Yeah. So, all right. So the checks are in the mail, and I was kiddingly saying we spend it on gas, but they're talking about it going up to over $4 a gallon.
Right, I know.
Yeah.
It's really depressing, especially since I drive a big old
hunker.
Ridiculous.
Those are going down the drain.
Oh, yeah.
The little ones are now.
I have 1 year left on that, and that's it. And, yeah, I saw something on the dreaded television the other day. There was something in the paper as well, I think today, in the Free Press.
Yes, what?
And people are buying smaller cars, smart cars and things like that.
Not smart cars. Those are those little teeny-weeny things.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't mind little cars at all.
Mm-hmm.
But when I've been in a small car and I'm surrounded by SUVs and hum jobs and whatever they are.
Yeah. Hummers.
Hummers, are they?
Right.
I knew it was something like that. But anyway, where is the government getting this $168 billion?
That's a really good question. Wait, aren't they giving? They're giving us our own money.
Well, but we're in debt.
Yeah.
So, what the hell, crank out another $168 billion. Actually, they're borrowing it. And the deal is that we'll get this $168 billion, and then with these expanded gas prices, which essentially is a tax on us that goes to the oil producers, including countries like Saudi Arabia, which then loans us money for the government to operate and do things like give tax rebates.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, this is a house of cards, dude.
It really is.
Chevron earnings up 10% on record oil prices. ExxonMobil, first quarter profits up 17%, and they're pissing and moaning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I saw that.
Yeah. And, of course, we're being gouged, dear friends, because if their prices went up and at the same time our prices went up, they would be making the same profit.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And it says, Exxon, it was its second best quarter ever. While we suffer.
Citizen.org, which is a public citizen started by, what's his name? The guy, right? Well, how could I blank on this guy? You know, the guy that's running for president.
Ralph Nader.
Ralph Nader.
Yes.
Wow.
Ooh.
People we've interviewed before, Tyson Slocum and Joan Claiborne, she's president of Public Citizen, and Tyson is the director of their energy program, said oil executives and speculators are getting rich on the backs of American consumers. This is because I want to emphasize, folks, this isn't like bad weather. It's just happening. He says, indeed, on average, it costs a company such as ExxonMobil about $20 to extract a barrel of oil, which in turn is sold for more than $115 a barrel. We're not talking about refining here. We're talking about at the wellhead, it costs them $20 to bring it out, and then they're selling it for $115. Refiner profit margins have also been soaring at vertically integrated oil companies, which helps explain how the largest five oil companies in America have posted more than $500 billion in profits since 2001. And who's paying it, dear friends? You and me.
Yeah.
Well, OPEC the group that, pardon me, that says that the oil-producing nations, a number of them, says oil could hit $200 a gallon, or a barrel, $200 a barrel. I can't do the math on it, but that'd be about $7.5, $8 a gallon, maybe about $7 a gallon or something like that.
Wow.
And what they don't...
So you say it's not true.
Yeah, but what they don't understand is that, it says basic economics, the Times, New York Times says that, suggested that consumption would fall because of the high prices, and supplies would rise as producers drilled for more oil. But as prices flirt with $120 a barrel, many energy experts are becoming worried that neither seems to be happening. Well, that is weird that consumption is not falling. But, you know, I think it's going to, because for the first time, mm-hmm. I'm starting to think, do I really want to drive there?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. You know, we both live close enough that we could...
Here?
Know, yeah, that we could ride a bike.
We could ride our bikes here.
I know. I have. I just need air in the tires. You know, I'm reading stories of fallout all the time, and there was just this sad story of this small-town milkman who had to quit his route because he couldn't afford gas prices. So it's affecting everyone.
And, well, you know, truckers, they're paying, I forget what it is, about a buck more a gallon. Is it at least $4.35 or something
like that? Businesses everywhere are hurting.
Well, Warren Buffett, the big financier, he says he thinks that the stock market crisis is over, but that still the average person is going to be suffering under the Bush economics for a long, long time.
Yeah.
You do realize, people, that it's under his watch and there ain't nobody else to blame other than this guy who has sent $500 billion a year down the rat hole for Iraq and cut taxes for the wealthy.
I have no problem blaming him.
Yeah, yeah. He is the man. The buck stops there whether he wants to put it there or not.
You know, I was talking with my neighbors about this, you know, about prices and you know, hard times. And I wonder if this will be a shift toward kind of more communal living and people helping each other out, you know, bringing people together.
That could.
I don't know.
Well, Hillary Clinton was pressed to name an economist who supports her plan to temporarily suspend the federal gas tax.
Oh, yeah.
It's like 18 cents a gallon. And it turns out that over the summer, it would save, like, each person $70. Now, if $70 was laying on the ground, I would pick it up.
You bet.
It's not like it's a nickel or something like that. But that doesn't really cut into what it's all about. Particularly, we're talking about if gas prices, like it's about $3.60 now, right?
Yeah.
So if it went up to $4 and then it was 18 cents less, and it's $3.82 a gallon.
Right.
And I agree with Barack Obama. That's a gimmick, and it's a Republican gimmick.
Yeah. So, well, she's a good Republican.
Well, come on. She's going to, well, she's not going to be, I don't even know about that. I don't, from everything I read, she's not going to be the Democratic Party candidate. She says she will be behind Barack Obama 100% if he wins the nomination.
Yeah, and then she went back and stabbed him with a knife after she said it. Those two are really picking at each other.
Yeah. Have we said lately that this is Night Call on WRIF? I'm Peter Werby, with me Jalene Jordan. And if you'd like to call in, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Al Slayer, our producer, will pick up... your calls. Please join us. Should we?
I think he's part psychologist in there. I've decided too.
Why?
Because he chats with the folks who vent on him before they get to us.
And then, actually, I haven't even looked at our screen here. Let me see if no. But I would invite Paul Pearson. Paul Pearson is from Detroit Liberation. And I spoke down at Grand Circus Park yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, for the big marijuana legalization event.
Yeah, I worked, so I didn't get to come down.
And we heard James and the Rainbows. They were rocking.
Were they good?
Yeah, they were good.
Great. The greatest name of a band I've heard lately.
And, you know, the Detroit. I mean, I started off with my talk there by saying to the people assembled that you're really special people, which speakers say that all the time, right? So it's not just like...
You weren't BS.
No, because there was not very many people there. If there was 100, yeah.
And John Sinclair was down there?
No, he was at a similar rally in New York City.
Oh, really?
So I want Paul Pearson to call in at 313-298-WRIF, and he knew what was happening all around the world because this was a world event. It was, in fact, you can go to globalmarijuanamarch.org. And I started off because a friend of mine said, what the hell are you speaking there for? It's just some stoner event, right?
Hmm.
And I said, well, it is more than that. But if it was just a stoner event, I would still go to support the rights of people not to have the government invade their internal space.
Yeah.
The government has no right to tell us what we can do with our minds or our bodies. They can advise us what to do. They can say what's potentially harmful. It wouldn't get too far with marijuana because it's not too much harm and all that.
It helps people who are ill, too. And there was, did you read that story? There was a guy who was dying of some horrible disease, and they wouldn't give him the...
Medical marijuana?
Yeah, no, he suffered horribly.
Oh, man. Well, there's lots of stuff. Medical marijuana, hemp for food, fuel, fiber, yeah. Stuff like that. But
even Henry Ford knew it. Come on.
What about the stoners, though?
Yeah? Right.
Yeah.
Right. Be free.
Be free, right. As long as you're not hurting anybody, not endangering anybody,
right.
And
yeah.
Stuff like that. And I want to actually say, I want to give a shout-out to Hilo. Hilo, who is listening to this program, he had saved this old UAW magazine, Solidarity,
yeah.
Of which when I and you and Tom Hartman and Mike Malloy worked for the old IE America network,
mm-hmm.
There was a photograph of me and Mike, and we were on the back page. That must have been like 2000.
Yeah.
So Hilo comes up and says, man, I listen to you all the time. Here, can you?
And he wanted your autograph.
And I signed it.
That is fabulous.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. I like his name, too.
Hilo. Well.
I know it's a nickname.
Well,
great.
Yeah, I thought it kind of had double meaning.
Oh.
Because he used to operate a Hilo.
Oh, he did.
You had the absolute wrong meaning to begin with.
I just thought it sounded fun.
So, Paul, give us a shout. All right, Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF. Right back to get your calls.
This is WRIF.com. 101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Hello, how are you?
Hey, it's Mike, and Monday morning we talk with comedian Chelsea Handler's got a new book out entitled Are You There, Vodka? It's Me, Chelsea. Are you still dating Ted Harbert, the CEO of Comcast?
Yep, he's asleep in our hotel room right now while I do my press for my book.
Oh, man, there's a catch. Good for you.
Thank you. I keep telling him it's good for him.
You know, I was reading in your book about your summer house in Martha's Vineyard, and it was funny because the first thing I thought was like, wow, her parents got a lot of money. And then
they don't. That's what I talk about in the book, about how you think we have a lot of money, and we don't, because my father thinks he was a used car dealer, but never sold anything.
Right.
Last night we all had dinner, and he goes, I got to go show a car. I'm like, to who? My sister's like, to himself.
Yeah.
He hasn't sold a car. I mean, our childhood was so awful and stupid and embarrassing because we had like 15 used cars in our driveway, and the year was like 1985, and nothing was like from anything after 75. So it was pretty embarrassing growing up.
Well, your dad made a great move there. Didn't I read something like I bought 10 acres out there for 28 grand, something like that?
Yeah, exactly. I talk because people, I would automatically assume, they, Martha's Vineyard, you have money. It's like, well, it's not quite what you think. My dad's a pretty embarrassing guy. Like, you know, he doesn't really have any manners, so like he'll just like go to the bathroom wherever he feels like it. If he like goes to the supermarket, he's like, oh, just hold on a second real quick. And you're like, why are your pants around your ankles, okay? You can't just pee in a parking lot. It's pretty humiliating. He thinks he's like a Doberman.
There's some good stories about him in the book, too. Of course, one is you took him on vacation and people thought you were honeymooners.
Yeah, and keep in mind, he's like 275 pounds, bald, and, you know, obviously a hot mess. And people are like, oh, we got upgraded. I thought it was a courtesy. And they're like, oh, no, we thought you were on your honeymoon. I'm like, what? And that's because that's what my father told everyone.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he's like, oh, it's a good way to get upgraded. Because he's convinced I'm a lesbian, because even though that I live with my boyfriend, because I'm a comedian, he's like, oh, no, no. But he won't say the word lesbian. He just points at his, like, as if that's a sign. And then he'll make a grunting sound. He's like, you're not a, are you? I'm like, get away from me. Please stop pointing at your okay, we're at the supermarket.
I'm at the supermarket.
Anymore, there's such a discrepancy in ages between people that are dating. Anything is believable, you know.
Yeah, well, no, my boyfriend's like 20 years older than me right now, so.
He's not a redhead, is he?
No redheads. They're dangerous.
Yeah, you talk about redheads. We've laughed about redheads on the show for a long time.
They're ridiculous. Well, first of all, they shouldn't be called redheads. They should be called bright orange heads. They're never red.
For whatever reason, I've always decided that they all have abnormally pink wieners.
Well, and they, well, yeah, surrounded by what looks like a clown in a leg lock.
Mike in the Morning. No subscription necessary on 101 WRIF. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. And Jillian Jordan is with me. And you folks who have been so patient on hold.
Yeah.
We haven't even told you. For the bashful and for when the lines are filled like now, you can go to calltalkyes at yahoo.com. Calltalkyes at yahoo.com. Short messages are preferred. Here's Monster Mike in Beeham. You're on the air. Go ahead.
This is Monster Mike. I just wanted to inform you about there's a friend of mine over, whom I meet over in Caribou Coffee in downtown Royal Oak.
Yeah.
And he plays with a rock band called The Insurgency. Have you ever heard of them?
I haven't, but I have gotten coffee at Caribou there. Yeah.
Well, anyways, I have a flyer here. This band They play like songs that protest the current administration, like stuff similar to what you played on your program before. And just give an example. Here's a couple of names of the songs they have. He has a song called "Hypocritical Rush" about Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And then there's another one. I Learned Hate from the Church and State. It's about a friend of his that's a lesbian, and she was like persecuted by the church and state supposedly. But anyways, I have this paragraph to read. I have a flyer. I have this paragraph to read you like the information.
Wait. Not the whole paragraph. Just I mean they're going to.
We
appear.
Can probably find these guys on MySpace.
Are they going to appear somewhere?
Well, yeah, it's just a very short paragraph. Just let me read it.
Now, tell me the info.
He doesn't let people sing whole songs.
When and where? When and where are they playing?
Well, the artist, the guy's name is Greg Panzica, and like the money that goes to charitable organizations like environmental protection, planet activist organizations, atrocities committed by the current leadership, including neoconservative controlled corporate media empire, and they have a website. You want to write this down? It's www.theinsurgency.us.
Wait, what's the insurgency?
Yes, www.theinsurgency.us.
Sounds like he's talking about Bush.
.us. T-A-G, right? Okay. Thanks for that info. Did you write that down, Jillian?
Yes, I did.
Okay. We will check it out. Monster Mike, thanks for checking up on that. Oh, let's see. Where are we at now? Here's Dan in Port Huron. Dan, go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, what's up?
I had a question, actually, about earlier you were talking about the checks being in the mail from the U.S. government.
Yeah.
How are they going to handle the situation with gays and lesbians with not only civil unions, but also adoptions?
No go. They're nothing.
They are non-entities.
Once again, they don't count.
Getting hosed, I mean?
Yeah, once again, they're getting hosed. You're right.
Yeah.
Completely.
I'm not one myself, but I mean, I just don't think that's fair in any way, shape, or form because what do they do wrong except, you know, love a person of the same sex?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's wrong, you know.
Yeah, we tend to agree with that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. Well, we've made some progress and more can be made, that's for sure. Well, thank you for bringing that up, Dan.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number here. And here's Chris and Warren. Chris, it's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, guys. My favorite time of night. I'm at work at a closed location. However, I do live in Warren. I wanted to give you the reported estimates, if you didn't already say it on your show, about the quarter earnings for the oil exec companies.
Well, we got it for the companies, but do you have them for the CEOs?
Nah, I probably have to do a little further research. I got to work right now, but this is my favorite time of night, and I just like to call and always input.
Tell us what you got
far. Well, it just basically said $17 million for the quarter earnings, which is a three-month period.
Wait. Must be billion.
Okay, possibly billion. Then.
Yeah, million's nothing. That's what they have in their pockets.
Right. And then as far as where we're getting our money from, it's basically the foreign dignitaries. And I actually found out about that doing a little research on Donald Trump's most recent book.
Yeah.
And basically they get the money from the foreign dignitaries or so, and then basically, like you mentioned earlier in the show, they have to raise the gas price or whatever they do in order to pay the expense of the debt that we accumulate so much in general to begin with.
All right, man. Thank you for the info. It is just sort of a racket, isn't it? Let's see.
That's putting it mildly.
Yeah. There's Jason in Westland. Jason, hi. You're on the air.
All right, cool. Yeah, politicals? Yeah, that's bull. Well, anyways, gas prices are killing me.
I can imagine.
Yeah, so, like, how are you surviving?
No, how am I surviving? Yeah, barely.
Right.
No, I just, a presidential run. Now, right. They really, not to be racist or anything, but they really say
Wait, that's racist even saying that.
wait, go ahead. What were we going to say?
Come on. The people of the United States, are they really going to put a black man in office?
I think maybe.
I don't know.
I don't know.
I think that there's people that are so stupid that that they would actually care what about someone's skin pigmentation.
Yeah, or their name. And I heard a story today about this friend of mine. His sister apparently is just dumb as a rock. Okay, let's just say it. And she said, I'm not going to vote for no Iraqi.
Yeah, so
this is the mentality out there, people.
Well, I hope not. Let's get people some smartening pills, that's for sure. Thank you for that. Yeah. I actually got this email, and I will, you know what, I won't even name the name. Well, I could. No one's going to know who the hell this is. I won't. Somebody who's on my email list for my, all of a sudden it did get very warm in here, didn't it?
I'm sweating.
Yeah.
I'll be right back.
Yeah. Oh, you're just kicking the heat down. That's good. I thought you were leaving the room.
No.
So I get this email from someone who's on my email list for the station. If you want to be on my list, which I don't send out that much, but at least you can say you're on my list, call talkyes@yahoo.com, also for comments as well. And I'm almost afraid to read this on the air because someone will hear a little snippet of it and think it's the truth. But, you know, there's all these all this insane stuff that comes across
on Fox News.
Well, no, but then on the internet as well.
Oh, sure.
I mean, way worse than. So this person who's on my list, who I think has sent me an email before, she sends me a petition that says, as stated below, the Senate voted this week to allow illegal aliens access to Social Security benefits. So I'm thinking, that's not true. That's not true.
It's not.
In the slightest.
Mm-mm.
Attached is an opportunity to sign a petition that requires citizenship for eligibility to that social service and blah, 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 blah. So what I immediately do is I didn't even go to Snopes, Snopes.com. I went to, because I thought, gee, maybe they, maybe the Senate did pass this bill. But, you know, this would be the biggest story of the absolute.
Think of the outrage of the people who don't want the immigrants here at all, which does not include me.
And actually, citizens, I don't think you have to be a citizen to get Social Security.
Right.
In other words, if you're a legal resident and you've paid into it. But so this was so right away, you know, I went to the Snopes.com, said, no, this is not true. It's absolutely fake. And besides that, there are a lot of articles to show that, on the average, illegal immigrants contribute as much as $13 billion a year to the Social Security Fund because they're here working, like with phony papers or phony Social Security numbers. So it goes into the fund, and they have absolutely no way to get it out. Yeah. So in that regard, you notice how all the steam had has kind of gone out of that immigration thing?
Isn't it amazing? It kind of resurfaced a little bit this week because of the big march.
Yeah, but they weren't even that big. They were like 10%.
Yeah, I saw the footage of it, and I remember it was last year, right, when it was so huge here in Detroit.
Right.
It was way, way, way down.
Well, the reason that people that have been essentially driven off their land in Mexico by NAFTA, and the small percentage of them that decide they're going to go where the jobs are and come here, if there's not jobs here, they're not going to come.
Right. You know, I was having a conversation with another person we work with here about immigration, and I said, you know what? Have you ever been to Mexico? Have you ever seen the poverty and the struggle down there? And, of course, no. But I said, if I were there and I were struggling, my butt would be going right across that border as well, illegally.
Sure.
You got to do what you do to survive, to feed your family.
Well, there is this guy who, you know, some of these people have been so twisted by this immigration issue. And someone who's been very active in the legalization marijuana movement suddenly went off on this tangent and started running this completely hysterical line. When he saw me yesterday down at the marijuana, at the Liberation Marijuana, whatever it was, rally in Grand Circus Park, he said, "How many people can this country hold? 600 million? You know, 300 million more?" I'm thinking.
Wait, why was he talking about that?
Well,
you?
Yeah, I told him, don't write me anymore. This was like 6, 8, 10 months ago when everybody, you know, like Lou Dobbs was whipping everybody into this, hysteria.
Frenzy.
That we were going to be, drowned in this wave of brown-skinned people and all that. And the only reason that anybody's going to come here, again, if there's jobs and if like too many illegal immigrants came here and saturated the job market, they would say, well, there's no jobs here.
That's a good point.
We won't come. So the idea that there would be this endless stream to the point where Mexico would finally empty out because I forgot how many people are in Mexico, but not enough to add another 300 million to this country. So it's just, total hysteria, and it was like nothing had changed. But
it is hysteria because the same individual I was talking to the other day about immigration, who we work with, said, the Mexicans are taking over this country. I thought, are you serious? I mean, I thought it was a joke.
Is this?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, no. He's twisted. He's totally twisted. Oh, yeah.
We still love you.
Yeah, yeah. What's your pronouns? One of the things, though, I started off this was talking about this email that I got. So be real careful about that. The worst ones are the ones that are attributed to George Carlin. They keep putting out all this stuff that George Carlin said this, George Carlin said that.
That he didn't say.
And they're almost always generated by the right wing. So you get these people that ostensibly are liberals or that care about this country, and they're repeating the most, most stupid right-wing stuff, and they think because it came out of the mouth of a cynical iconoclast like George Carlin, who has said a lot of cynical and iconoclastic stuff, but most of it good and nothing. Yeah. See, I mean, someone will send me a purported George Carlin statement. I look at it and I go, this isn't George Carlin.
You know it immediately.
Yeah. Am I smarter than you? I mean, come on. And the other thing that they do that's really dumb is that they'll say, I've got to send this to everybody. So they'll send it to like 45 people, and they'll put it all in the email on the CC line.
You can see everyone else's email address.
And what you got to do, here's what
that
netiquette is.
That causes wars in my circles.
No lie, because you're opening people up to spam. And what happens? So I wrote every one of these people back, and I said, this is nuts. You're sending out crap. Is it what you do is you send it to yourself. Like if I want to, when I send it to you folks that have,
they're on your list.
On my list. Thank you. That I send it to, calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
Okay.
And I put all of you in the BCC.
Oh, right. That's how that's done.
Yeah.
Okay.
You didn't know that?
Well, I don't ever send emails. So.
Yeah.
So I don't have that problem.
Well, and someone's going to say, well, I didn't know that. Well, learn the deal.
The etiquette.
Yeah, yeah.
Before you
the
regret it.
It's called the netiquette.
The netiquette, yes.
Yeah, the netiquette. All right. This, we got at least one Paul here. I'm wondering whether, is this the Paul we're looking for? I don't know. Come on. You know what's happening. Al Slayer is talking to him.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I mean, what you were talking about earlier. All right, let's go on. Here's Mac
counseling.
In Brighton. Mac, it's Peter and Jelena, WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Peter. How's it going?
It's going good.
Hey, I'm probably one of your youngest listeners out there. I'm 15.
We love it.
But you're not. You're one of them. We have 14-year-olds, but go ahead.
So we do. Yeah,
we do. Yeah.
All right. Well, anyways, the time has kind of deviated from this, but I just wanted to know what you guys thought. John McCain, I'd heard that his solution to the high gas problem was to cut the gas tax.
Well, yeah, but he and Hillary both are advocating
both of them,
a sort of a little moratorium during the summer on the federal tax, be about 18 cents less a gallon.
Yes. Yeah. Well, anyways, I thought that was kind of dumb because that funds our, like, highway service projects, doesn't it?
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
They can still raise the prices, you know?
Yeah.
Well, what'll happen is if people will drive more, then if the prices are lower, and then that'll drive the price up. So it's nowhere. It's just Obama's right. It's just a political stunt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. I just wanted to comment on that.
Good.
All right. Thank you, Mac.
Thanks for listening.
Appreciate it. Yeah, indeed.
Getting an early start in life on the right track there.
Age don't matter around
right.
here.
It does not.
Let's see. Here's Todd in Southgate. Todd, hi. You're on WRIF. Go ahead.
Hi. How's it going?
Good.
Did I understand you right earlier? You're against the war on drugs?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, it's, I'm trying to
think. How long do you have?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. How can I say this briefly? Well, what's happened is that this extraordinary amount of money has been spent, probably $1 trillion that has just been wasted on a war, if you call it that, which has been lost. Because drugs are still available everywhere. It's corrupted police forces all over the world, including ones in the United States.
The amount of people who are serving time and crowding our jails because they had a joint.
Yeah, it's made criminals of millions and millions and millions of our citizens. And it's a criminal act. And I have to say, I can't believe that there's a single person in this audience that doesn't know someone who at some time or other has used an illegal...
Inhaled.
Or, I don't mean them, themselves. No, I mean, but that knows somebody at least.
Yeah.
And so it has ruined the lives, the reputation, the prospects for careers. And essentially what it is provides customers for the prison industrial complex. So it takes your money and my money and shifts it to the government rather than dealing with our schools and our roads and our whatever else we know, making, you know, I mean, there was enough money to have financed a federal health care system for the last 40, 50, 60, 70 years if you dated back to, like, say, the Marijuana Stamp Tax Act in the late 30s. And ultimately, though, it's been an effort to stop people from using drugs that they want, where all of this money could have been used to get drugs to people that need them.
So in other words, the problem is too big for us, and you'd rather just give up on it.
I don't think why is it a problem?
Why are drugs a problem? Are you kidding? Are you seriously asking me this question?
Go ahead. I asked the question.
Well, probably because they destroy lives, they destroy families. I could go on and on.
Well, listen, the old argument is, I got to tell you, is what do you think is more destructive to lives and health and all of that, marijuana or alcohol?
On that issue, I will agree with you, probably alcohol.
Okay.
Oh,
good.
Yeah.
So, doesn't make any sense, does it? For one thing is that people have a certain responsibility. The government does not have, in my estimation, the right to intervene in the choices that have to do with our consciousness or our internal space, which includes our health. Most people that use drugs are drug users. There's a certain percentage, like with alcohol, that are drug abusers. Probably less with drugs than with alcohol. And there, you know, when you start toting up all the social damage that's done from alcohol with drunk driving, lost time on the job, health concerns, I can't even think of them all. I mean, they pale compared to even things like crack and heroin. And what if people want to do heroin? If I want to use heroin, what the hell business is it of anyone else's?
Because it's illegal. You should not have that choice to do that.
Wait. We're talking about the validity of a law. Why should there be a law that says that I cannot use heroin?
Because it's dangerous, and it can control your mind to a point to where you don't know what the heck you're doing.
Well, that's, you know what? there's the only problem that there's a problem with crime comes from the fact that it's illegal. I mean, you have people in, there is a full-scale armed warfare going on in the border towns in Mexico now with cocaine gangsters shooting it out with one another, 14 dead at a time, automatic weapons, killing police chiefs so they can sell the stuff that native people in Peru and Bolivia can just kind of mix up in about an hour and have been using it in the leaf form, at least, for hundreds and hundreds of years. It's the law that is the problem. And it's not, you know, yeah, I mean, I shouldn't be able to shoot heroin and go drive a bus, or an employer is not going to want me on the air if I'm going, like that. I mean, there's certain rules, just like my employer will not let me bring booze in here, will not let me drink on the job, will not let me, if I came here drunk, I would be in a world of trouble. But my right to enjoy myself or examine philosophically other planes of consciousness, what the hell concern of the government is it?
Well, why is it a concern of your employer what you do while you're at work? I mean,
oh, because it's his space, it's his job. I mean, because I would affect what my performance. The same thing would be true with anything. Like, for instance, you cannot smoke in this studio. You know why you can't smoke in this studio? Because we have these, what are those things, those readers of those, we don't even use CDs very much anymore, but those CD readers would actually, you know, the way...
They get gunky.
Would get gunky. So an employer would say, you can't smoke in here. Or an employer that is smart would say, employees cannot smoke on company property at all because that's going to affect health rates, it's going to health costs, and all of that. That's all. And just like they could say, no heroin use.
On the air.
You can't use heroin in our studios. That all makes sense. There's all sorts of regulations that make sense. But to say that it is illegal, it just becomes, I mean, we have wasted $1 trillion. And listen, right now I have no idea how to get heroin. But I'll bet you that within 12 hours I could score heroin.
I think all we have to do is go across 8 Mile, you know, really. I don't know. I've never done it in my life. I'm just saying.
What do you say? You just see somebody from Detroit and say, hey, man, you got any heroin?
I think it's pretty easy to find. I don't know. I just hear it from people I know who go over there and buy their
So if this is a war, my friend, like the war in Iraq, it has been lost.
What? Why? You don't even make any sense.
Well, you know what? How about this? Rather than saying stuff like that, just say what you believe because you're, you know what?
Well, it's obvious you listen to your mom and dad.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah. You're a good citizen.
Good.
You're to be congratulated.
Yeah.
All right. You know, actually, in some ways, that's the only people I want to talk to. I mean, because most people agree that these laws are absolutely outrageous, and they've been a total failure, that every drug, every banned substance is more powerful now, including marijuana.
Right.
Yeah. So
meanwhile, people are getting completely ripped out of their minds at the bar,
and
driving a 2-ton piece of machinery down the streets. I don't like that at all.
No, I don't like it at all.
No.
You call us and we'll get your call when we come back. Al Slayer waiting for your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And I'm going to check calltalkyes@yahoo.com right now.
WRIF.com. 101 WRIF will keep you rocking with Kid Rock all summer long. Keep it locked on the Riff all this week. Listen for the Kid Rock montage for your chance to beat the box office with tickets to see Kid Rock and his expanded 11-piece twisted brown trucker band featuring special guest Rev Run of the legendary Run DMC and surprise special guest at DTE Energy Music Theater Saturday, July 19th and Sunday, July 20th. That's right. The Riff is hooking you up with tickets to both shows. Tickets go on sale Saturday, May 3rd at 10 a.m. Keep it here for your chance to win. From the station that keeps you rocking all summer long.
What's happening? This is Kid Rock. You're listening to 101 Riff. Riff Rocks Detroit, baby.
Everything
rocks.
is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thanks a lot, and welcome back to our second hour. Jalene Jordan is with us at 1 a.m. Stan Cox, who is the... Actually, we're going to start with Mark Juergensmeyer. He's the author of Global Rebellion, Religious Challenges to the Secular State. So he interviewed a lot of jihadists and Christian militia guys and all over the world. Very interesting. Stan Cox, author, Sick Planet, Corporate Food and Medicine, how that's all pretty much screwing us up. A lot of food prices going through the ceiling, and riots for food and all that around the world, and these big corporations that are the big food conglomerates, they're making a fortune.
That's right.
Ain't that sweet. As I said earlier in the show, more Marines have been killed, this time back in Anbar province that they thought they had pretty much under control.
Yeah.
Not so. And there's fighting going on daily in the middle of this enormous city, Baghdad.
Can you imagine this?
It says, the ugly daily fight for ground in a poor Shiite neighborhood of Sadr City unfolded Saturday at a small mosque next door to a hospital, damaging the hospital and a number of its ambulances and near a group of children who were wounded as they gathered tin cans to sell for salvage. The missiles hit close to Sadr General Hospital, and they were American. After a night of clashes in the neighborhood, the Americans fired at least three precision-guided munitions at a small building next door to the hospital. Neighbors said the building was used as a place of prayer for pilgrims, hospital employees, and neighborhood residents, but the military identified it as a command center for the Shiite militias that it is battling. You know, this is their city. Why is our military... our sons and daughters, the sons and daughters of America, attacking people in the middle of the city with precision-guided munitions?
You know, if you really sit back and think about it, it really is just so mind-boggling. You say, is this real?
28 people wounded in the strike on the building as well. And let me see, where there was something in here. This is Mike Whitney. Mike Whitney from Information Clearinghouse. I think it's informationclearinghouse.com. Could be .org, but Information Clearinghouse. You can find it. He says, the U.S. military does not rule Iraq, or does it have the power to control events on the ground. It's just one of the many militias vying for power in a state that is ruled by warlords. And it's a civil war. We're backing one side of it. After the army conducts combat operations, it is forced to retreat to its camps and bases. This point needs to be emphasized in order to understand that there is no real future for the occupation. The U.S. simply does not have the manpower to hold territory or establish security. In fact, the presence of American troops incites violence because they are seen as forces of occupation, not liberators. Surveys show that the vast majority of the Iraqi people want the U.S. troops to leave. The military has destroyed too much of the country and slaughtered too many people to expect that these attitudes will change anytime soon. And on it goes. Let me see. Con Hallinan, who is a columnist for Foreign Policy and Focus, Death at a Distance, the U.S. Air War. He said, we need to really look at U.S. actions right now in Sadr City, like the increase in the use of air power in a packed urban environment and the enormous increase in the use of armed robot drones in Iraq like the Reaper. The press has given the military a pass on the air war in both Iraq and Afghanistan. The air war ends up alienating the civilian population and serves as a recruiting sergeant for the insurgents. And he talks about how 300,000 veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan are afflicted with post-traumatic stress disorder or major depression. Another 320,000 may have suffered traumatic brain injury. This means more than one-third of the troops who have served in Iraq and Afghanistan are casualties. What else? But so he says, so the U.S. government is resorting to an air war, which they hope will make it bloodless for us. A stepped-up air war will mean an increase in civilian casualties and greater anger at the United States. The U.S. military tried this tactic during the Vietnam War, but the touted increased firepower ended up alienating the South Vietnamese peasants.
Oh, yeah, let's do that all over again.
Yeah.
Jeez.
The current fighting in Sadr City is a case in point. According to U.S. figures, more than 500 people have been killed, 2,100 wounded since fighting broke out there in March. The Iraqis say these figures are much higher and that most of them are civilians.
Tragic.
Yeah. And this is kind of off the pages, and they're just talking about, Reverend Jeremiah Wright. Or
yeah, right.
Like that. All right, let's go back to our phone. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. And here's Jeff in Detroit. Jeff, it's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Pete. Hey, Jalene.
Hi.
Hello.
How you doing? I'm the Jeff that called last week about the nuclear weapons.
Oh, yeah. Hi.
What I wanted to say, you were talking earlier in the program about the guy that ran up to you and said about, you know, how many people can this country hold and all that.
Yeah.
Well, I got an interesting fact in case you ever run into him again. And if it's wrong, you can blame 2020 TV program, John Stossel. But anyway, here's the fact. On that program, they talked about that you could take the entire population of the world, 6 billion, and put it in the state of Texas. And it still would not be as crowded or have as many people per mile as New York City.
Damn. Well, how about this, Jeff, for illegal immigration? What's the biggest case of illegal immigration in the world? That was probably when the Pilgrims started it all coming here to the U.S., right? To America, to North America.
A place of selected amnesia.
Yeah.
You know, this country was founded on genocide and slavery.
You sound like Reverend Jeremiah Wright.
Who, me? No. But, you know, so we have a tendency, you know, you were just talking to the guy about the legalization of drugs. That's the other hypocrisy.
Yeah.
You know, alcohol, which is a drug, is perfectly legal, and you can blitz yourself out of your mind. But then they want to say this. You can't do this. You know, we got nuclear weapons, but you can't have them.
Well, you know, the drug war, we always talk about wasting money. I mean, we think it's wasting money because of the $1 trillion that's been spent on the war of drugs. Like I said, could have been used to make this country into it, to realize its potential and to solve so many of the economic problems we have. But, you know, it went to the building trades industry to build all those prisons. It hires all those guards. It pays taxes to all those municipalities. Prison uniforms, guns, more and more cops, on and on. So the war on drugs does not operate in order to suppress drugs. It operates in order to be this economic engine for this small sector of the economy.
You know, just like majority of traffic tickets they give out, they tell you it's for your own safety, but, you know, just the fact that the county or the city makes tons of money off of them has nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
Trust me.
Yeah.
All right, Jeff. Thank you so much. Appreciate your call.
I remember I had a traffic violation, and the cop said, oh, well, you know what? You did me a big favor. You helped me reach my quota for tonight.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Well, I don't think they can come in with no traffic.
With nothing.
I saw no speeders tonight.
Right. Well, it's pretty easy. I mean, people are driving like crap all over the place.
It's getting worse, isn't it?
Oh, it really is.
It is.
Yeah. Miami's just as bad, by the way, if not worse.
Huh.
It really is bad.
Here's Greg in New Baltimore. Greg, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Good.
I listen to your show often when I come home. I'm a law enforcement officer, and some of the things you say I do agree with, and some of the stuff I don't. But when you talked about the war on drugs, I felt compelled to call.
Sure.
I guess I'm going to throw a different spin on it. I can see what you're saying about, you know, legalizing everything and whatnot, but I'm looking at it like, boy, if you legalize it, you're going to make it a lot easier for everybody to get a hold of. And I think what a lot of people don't realize, because they don't deal with it every day like I do for the past 14 years I've been dealing with it, I look at this and I say to myself, wow, if they legalize it, it's going to get a lot easier for people to get their hands on. And a lot of people don't realize what comes with the use of drugs afterward, because a majority of crimes that are committed are committed as a result of drugs, believe it or not.
But no, wait. I'm sure you're right. But once you take away its artificially high price because of scarcity, that people aren't having to spend, I don't even know what the hell You know, back when I used to have some...
Back when they had dime bags?
Dime bags, and now, you know, now it's like $200 bags. That would all go away. The economic incentive would go away, just like it did with Prohibition.
Now, I don't think so, Peter. Once you legalize it, first of all, it's not a very high-priced drug to come across, especially marijuana nowadays. And the people I've dealt with and the people I talk to on a daily basis, the thing they're always telling me is I ask them often, hey, how did you get started in this? Well, it all started with marijuana.
The
old gateway drug.
And I'll tell you, most of the crimes we're dealing with, a lot of the violent crimes, even a lot of the minor crimes like the theft crimes, mm-hmm. it all comes down to, hey, I need to get money for drugs. Now, if you think it's that hard to get the drugs, no, you're right. It's not that hard to get the drugs now. But if you legalized it, I think you'd be compounding the problem because once you legalize it, it's even easier to get the drugs. Now, people are going to be experimenting with it. Then they're going to get hooked on it, and then they're going to have to come up with money to support it, and that's going to...
Well, it wouldn't. Nothing would be very expensive. In fact, probably the economic incentive to bring drugs from that have their origins in botanical origins in Asia or in Latin America probably wouldn't even be worth it. I don't know. You can't grow coca leaves or poppy. Well, maybe you can grow poppy here. Maybe you can. I don't know. But I can't imagine anything worse than what has occurred to millions and millions of citizens and has so distorted the criminal justice system in every way imaginable. I mean, can anything be worse than what's happening on the border of Mexico right now? I mean, let me ask you a very serious question. Greg, when you go out on a patrol, are you in fear of your life? I mean, real direct fear. I mean, worried about whether you're going to come home at night. I mean, I know you got to be wary and you got to be prepared and all that, but are you fearful every night you're out on duty? I doubt it.
Not all the time, but there are times when come across
situation, I know, but here's my point. In Mexico right now, I don't know if you're following this, but your brother officers in Mexico are under this severe military assault from well-armed narcotraficante gangs that have weapons sometimes that are superior to the police. In places like Tijuana and other border towns, police chiefs have been assassinated, high-ranking officers that have been actually trying to break up the drug trade. This is all because of its illegality and the enormous fortune that can be reaped from it. But even if that wasn't the case, the fact that millions and millions of people have, on one hand, it's been a waste that police and court time has been taken up from this, but also it has been what's been done to the lives of people. I always use an example, a friend of mine who made his living supplying cocaine to wealthy adult lawyers. Well, he will probably get out next year after mm-hmm. serving 20 years in federal prison. This was consenting adults, people that are the pillars of their community that are still practicing law. I don't know whether they're still doing cocaine or not.
Getting high.
Whether they are or they aren't. I mean, it just ain't working. I don't know what could be worse.
Well, I guess the only thing I could say is, like I said, once you legalize it, you make it easy for everybody to get on it. Now, a lot more people are going to be on it. Then they're going to need money to support it, and that's going to lead to crime, believe it or not.
Well, what happened before this? You know, heroin didn't used to be illegal. Cocaine didn't used to be illegal.
Right, it was a pharmaceutical.
Marijuana did not used to be illegal.
I understand the pharmaceutical issues with the marijuana. And yeah, there are some people that legitimately need it for medical reasons. I don't have a problem with that. But, mm-hmm. Like I said, I deal with it on the street all the time. I'm dealing with these crimes, and most of the people that are committing these crimes are hooked on drugs. Now, these consenting rich people are out there that are getting this cocaine, that needed this cocaine for whatever reason, how they're living their life, I have no idea. But I find it unusual that you got consenting adults wanting to buy cocaine and they're not addicted. And then, so what do they go about their business and go to their daily jobs?
Well,
and
most, consume cocaine. I mean, as I always have this long litany, throughout my life, I have known, I'll start with your category. Police officers, prosecutors. In fact, I knew a guy who was a prosecutor in Miami-Dade County. His job was prosecuting cocaine offenders.
And he did it.
He did tons of blow. Judges.
I think a lot of people just do it recreationally, here and there, there are a lot of recreational.
You have never, I don't want to put you on the spot, Greg, but you have never seen or heard of police officers doing the drugs that they confiscate? Okay, never mind.
I personally have never heard of that. I mean, I've heard of it out in the public, other cities. I personally have never been involved in that and don't know anybody that's been involved in that. And I can honestly say that I've never arrested somebody for having one joint and them go to prison for that, some of the comments that were made earlier. I've never seen that happen. I don't think our jails are filled with people that have had minor amounts of a drug.
Sure they
because
are. I don't know that they're filled.
I'll tell you what, I've been to court time and time again for 14 years, and I've never sent anybody to prison because they had a joint on them. You know what I mean? I mean, and again, I can't speak for other officers or the rest of the world. Maybe you guys know of some people that that's happened to, but I've never in my 14 years as a cop seen that happen.
Well, there's 500,000 people a year arrested for marijuana possession.
Okay, marijuana possession at what level?
Well, I don't know. I mean, if people...
Because a half a joint ain't going to get you 30 days in jail.
No. All right, well,
it ain't going to get you five.
That's an enormous number of people. For one thing, it means that it sort of creates disrespect for the law. I mean, it's a mass phenomenon. I mean, there are... If imagine that. 500,000 people get caught. How many people aren't getting caught? No one, I mean, not that I really know anybody, but, no one I know of or heard of or something like that, however you want to put it, ever gets busted. I mean, I don't even know who gets busted, but it seems to be a crime that, that a relatively small proportion of the actual people using actually get caught. And yet 500,000 people come afoul of the law. Tom, give me your last, or I'm sorry, Greg, give me your last thought because I got to move on.
Okay. Well, I just appreciate being able to voice my opinion here on your show. And I hope for our nation's youth that we continue to fight the war on drugs, believe it or not. I really do.
Okay. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Did I just blow that other person off too? I hope not. But I may have.
If so, call back.
Yeah.
Please.
Here's Paul in Sterling Heights. Paul, it's Peter and Jalene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
Hey.
Hi.
It's your favorite dinosaur auto worker electrician.
Okay.
Hello.
You might remember me from back a while ago.
Welcome back.
Remember, we talked about this at the Jazz Fest. As I did not smoke tobacco around you, I asked you which two businesses in Windsor put in pleasure boat docks after alcohol was made illegal in Michigan. Do you remember that?
Paul, do you know this is Peter Werby?
Yeah, we talked at the Jazz Fest. We're sitting together.
I believe in Peter.
The two businesses that put pleasure docks in after alcohol prohibition were Seagram's and Hiram Walker.
Oh, yeah.
Why would they put in pleasure boat docks after alcohol was illegal in Michigan? Why would they do that?
I'm not totally following you, but...
Okay, anyhow.
Yeah.
War on drugs was coined in 1967. Are we winning yet?
No.
Okay.
They don't want to win. They don't want to win.
Peter, you got to make it into bumper sticker stuff. Are we winning yet? No. Okay, but that's not what I called you about. I called you about aliens.
But wait a minute, I want to tell you, though, they don't want to win. They want a stasis. They want things to remain as they are because there can be this expenditure of hundreds of billions of dollars in this perpetual war. It's like 1984. The war goes on forever, and it's a way, as I said at the beginning of the show, just like so much in this society. They take our personal wealth, transfer it to the government, which then allots it, not to goods and services for us, but to select industries, law enforcement, and what have you. So it's a racket, essentially.
Okay. But I called. I wanted to call you about aliens.
Yeah, you mean there is a from outer space?
I'm telling you, worse than that, dude.
What?
Worse than that, gay aliens.
Gay aliens?
Gay aliens. They come and recruit your kids. You never see them again. They go off planet. Just remember that. I'm cluing you in, dude.
All right. Remember, folks, you heard it here. We haven't been reading any email, and let's see. Tracy writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Hey, Peter and Jalene, my name is Tracy from Port Huron. My husband, Robert, is a regular listener to your show. He says that Fox News Channel is a Republican channel that needs to be removed from the airwaves. I don't believe that it is.
Oh, no, Tracy? Yeah. Oh, yeah, it is.
Yeah, yeah. Hubby's got you on that one.
Yeah. Just watch it.
Yeah.
You'll see.
Yeah. And way back, we were talking about the price of milk going up. And Stephen writes in the calltalkyes@yahoo.com, please note that rises in milk prices are not a cause of a lack of production, but rather the skyrocketing cost of feed for the animals. Remember that this is all engineered. That is all planned. This is the secret agenda. As far as these economic numbers, how do we know that the numbers are not being cooked, say, by no longer counting the cost of oil and bread in the calculations, as was done ever since the Great Depression? I'm not sure that the last sentence there, but it is, the old thing, figures don't lie, but liars can figure.
Right. Yeah.
And a long message from Tom in Minneapolis, but I'll just give you a shout-out. It's a bit too much to read right now. Okay, 313-298-WRIF, and let's see, here's Josh in West Branch. Josh, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I don't know, I want to talk about immigration, but sure. I don't want to anymore. I want to say that, you know, people complain about food prices and all that, but, you know, they why don't they take care of themselves, you know? I mean, you know.
What does that mean? What do you mean?
Get some chickens and have eggs, you know, raise a garden, you know.
The
way of life we live is completely wrong.
Well, here's the thing, you know, you're in the city.
No, I'm not. I live up north.
Okay, well, I am, and so, I just can't imagine having chickens in my backyard.
Well, you don't have to have a rooster. I mean, why do you live in the city, though? Why do you want to live with somebody
I'd love to live in the country. I would, I would love to live in the country, but...
I like to go there once in a while.
This is reality.
I like the city. Yeah, people for the last 700-800 years have been... I don't know. I think the majority of people lived in cities. Certainly now, the majority of people in the world live in cities, which ain't so good because of the way the world economics are. But everybody can't come to the country.
It'll just be a big country city.
Yeah. What if we all come to West Branch? What if we all come to West Branch?
Well, you know, there's plenty of land in the country. Everybody can go to their own place. You know, you don't have to have some $300,000 house, all these people looking to buy all these nice new houses.
Well, neither of us have those big houses, but
yeah.
You know,
well, my house used to be worth $300,000. Now it's worth about
$120,000. I know. You know what? I'm glad to live in the city right now because we both live pretty close to the radio station. And with gas prices, it's quite brilliant.
Well, one, I don't know that we could have chickens, but one of the things that ought to be done, and it's difficult in northern climes, is that we ought to have agriculture that is closer to our cities rather than having this food chain that goes so far around the world. And so then the fuel prices, of course, are a big item. Now, everything is... I don't know that everyone moving to the country or all of us raising chickens is the answer, but you're on to something. I agree.
Do you have chickens?
He's gone. Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was curious if he had chickens of his own. Probably.
Cristobal says, hey, that last caller, I think this is way back with the guy that was, not Greg, the police officer, but the other guy.
The other guy who was freaking out on you.
Yeah, about the war on drugs. Needs to get his head out of his butt. He made no sense talk about someone who was born with ignorance. I wanted to call, but by the way, he's just more insult. By the way, Peter, it's true. If someone wants to use drugs in his own home, more power to them. It's none of our government's business. Where alcohol will allow someone's ignorance to be put on the road, and us innocent citizens have to suffer.
Yeah.
Do what I do and report those bastards on the road to the Michigan State Police.
Well, I gotta agree. The drunk driving is just really bothersome.
Let's see. Here's another war on drugs. Ryan says to respond and to help a previous caller. Alcohol is a larger problem because it is a legal substance. Legalizing other recreational drugs may create just as big of a problem. Let me say this to you and to Greg, to Ryan here. We have got ourselves in so many jams, in so many places where we're damned if we do and damned if we don't. And Iraq is one of them, to be sure. But I don't know what the social consequences would be if they're if they allowed drugs to be legalized. I think a lot more people would use them, and there could conceivably be, because Americans have no self-control, there could be more drug problems. But it's not a criminal problem, and the problems that are attendant to this this drug prohibition are so awful, such a waste of money. So, I mean, people wind up in, I mean, you know, the misery that's created. I mean, I don't agree with Officer Greg that that drugs themselves create crime. I mean, it's the drug laws that that turn people into criminals for on a number of different levels. But no matter what happened, because I think after prohibition was ended, I think the alcohol problems and alcoholism rose.
Oh, really?
Although booze was available almost everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, it was amazing. In fact, the consumption, no, that's not right. You know, I think the consumption of alcohol actually, how they would know since it was illegal, I don't know. But I think the consumption of alcohol actually rose
when
during the 1920s.
Illegal.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, people were nuts to drink.
Well, yeah, when you can't get something, you don't care.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Because I would say that most people that take hallucinogenic drugs do not go on homicidal rampages.
No, they just laugh a lot and sit around and laugh.
I think the people that go on homicidal rampages either have been on pharmaceutical drugs or just on good old-fashioned male anger.
Yeah, well, yeah.
There's that old thing.
Lots of testosterone.
Testosterone poisoning. Yeah. Here's Corey in Dearborn. Corey, it's Peter and Jalene. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going? I would just like to make a quick comment about the war on drugs. The only reason that these kind of drugs aren't legal is because it'd be taking away money from two of the biggest industries in America, which are what? The alcohol and the tobacco industries.
Yeah. But I don't know.
I've heard that before.
Don't
argument.
You think people, I don't know, I mean, couldn't, actually, it'd be kind of hard to smoke a cigarette with one hand and a joint with the other. I have to.
Well, it's kind of true, and it'd probably end up being cheaper and all such things like that. But also, if you look at it, it's like people were killing each other back in the 20s for prohibition with alcohol and all that. People are killing each other nowadays because of the drug laws, like you said. And if it were to be legalized, then people would be okay. And how many deaths do you hear from marijuana use?
No one dies from pot.
Nobody.
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 Nobody. So what's the big deal?
Deathless.
Doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
At all.
I agree. All right. Thank you very much. I knew at least two lawyers that couldn't write briefs unless they smoked down. Yeah.
Really?
And then they'd write these briefs that I thought sucked, and they'd say, "Wow, man, look at this.
That's brilliant, man.
Brilliant, man. Man, everybody like wants to talk about drugs. Okay. What the hell?
it's open forum.
You're humble servant here. Here's Kathy in Southgate. Kathy, hi. It's Peter and Jalene.
Hi. I completely agree with what you're saying about the whole drug war. It's ridiculous. We should take the lesson from cigarettes and prohibition that what is stop cigarette smoking is education.
Mm-hmm.
And you would take the crime out of it if you legalized it. And it very much irritated me when my sister was dying of cancer when her doctor said, "Oh, we don't want her getting hooked on marijuana.
Oh, give me a break."
Exactly.
Wow.
Unfathomable. So drugs should be legalized. Education should be pushed. And people are not going to do them more because if you educate them, they're going to know the dangers. They're going to see the problems. And birds, for God's sakes, eat fermented berries. It's a natural thing to seek relaxation on your own time.
To alter your state of consciousness.
Yeah. Well, they used to give, in bird feed, they used to give marijuana seeds because they thought that it increased, and, you know, birds in cages, that it increased their songs.
Really?
Yeah, really, yeah.
Didn't know.
Yeah. Yeah, we should probably play Bob Dylan right now. You know, Rainy Day Women, Everybody Must Get Stoned.
Oh, right. I know the song.
Thank you, Kathy. We'll be right back.
This is
WRIF.com. The $40,000 Riff Rock Air Search is on. 101 WRIF and Bud Light are looking for one woman to represent the Riff for 1 year. And now, it's up to you to decide. Log on at WRIF.com and vote for your favorites from the sexy 16 to advance to the exotic 8. Only you will decide who will be the next Riff Rock Girl. Representing the Riff with VIP access to concerts and events. An on-air gig with the world-famous 101 WRIF and a $40,000 salary. The 2008 Riff Rock Girl Search. Brought to you by Bud Light. Keeps it coming at 101 WRIF. Everything rocks. WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Julian Jordan is with me. We were talking earlier with a caller who said he was probably the youngest caller who and said he was 15 years old. And Dan wrote in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He said, I have a 5-year-old and a 1-year-old that listens to WRIF every night. The 5-year-old said he wants the riff on. He may not now everything being said. But if you turn the radio off, you may not understand everything that's being said. I see.
Okay.
Not a word. But if you turn the radio off, I have a 5-year-old complaining it's too quiet and a 1-year-old crying.
I'm sorry. Parenthood is hard.
Yeah.
So I hear.
Let's see here. Peter and Jolene, A.E., writes in, why do we persist in speaking as though the administration cares what happens in Iraq? They already have achieved their mission goals for the war. The war has led to high oil prices. High oil prices have led to record profits for the oil companies. These record profits are going to persist for the foreseeable future, and since they'll be out of office soon, the next administration will be left to clean up the mess in Iraq. I don't think they'll even bother stealing the presidential election for anyone in November, because they also won't care about the mess they leave behind in Washington. It's the old story of take the money and run.
That's a good point.
Yeah. You know, actually, I forgot. It's did you see this one? I don't know if you saw this. U.S.-backed plan sees shiny future for the embattled green zone in Baghdad.
Really?
Yeah, that's where, well, forget the rocket attacks, concrete blast walls, and a lack of a sewer system. Now try to imagine luxury hotels, a shopping center, and even condos in the heart of Baghdad. This is all part of a five-year development dream list to transform the U.S.-protected green zone from a walled fortress into a centerpiece for Baghdad's future. But the $5 billion plan has the backing of the Pentagon and apparently the interests of some deep pockets in the world of international hotels and development. This is according to the lead military liaison for the project. For Washington, the driving motivation is to create a zone of influence around the new $700 million U.S. embassy to serve as a kind of high-end buffer to the compound, whose total price tag will reach about $1 billion after all the workers and offices are relocated over the next year. You understand what's happening here?
Yeah. Basically, giveaways to Bush's buddies who head up these corporations.
Yeah. Here's Ed in Rockwood. Ed, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air. Hey, Ed. Ed.
Hello.
Hey, Ed. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going, Peter?
Going good.
I was just calling in reference to that officer that called in earlier. You know, and he's saying, you know, that everybody's going to be on drugs and everything. I think that it would lead to a decrease in crime, for one thing.
I agree.
Because, you know, for one thing, gangs, you know, that's their main, you know, their main income is drugs. You know, when police officers, you know, talk, you know, they're talking from a bias kind of point because that's what, that's their job is to, you know, to bust people for that stuff. And, you know, I don't use drugs at all, but I don't see a problem with other people using them in their own homes.
Right.
Yeah. And to the people that think, that one guy wrote in and says he doesn't want people doing this, doing that. Well, of course, you don't want people doing that with anything that distorts their judgment or their capabilities to run whatever
they're doing. Drive a moving vehicle.
They can't even talk. For alcohol.
Yeah.
You know, why can't they have laws for, you know, for the drug use? I mean, and marijuana, come on now.
It's a flower.
You know, and that being a gateway drug is a bunch of bull.
Yeah, someone said on the air, that's usually not true. I mean,
that dare rhetoric.
Yeah, it could be, I mean, people that use marijuana, I don't know, are there people that use heroin for the first, you know, that's the first drug they use? Very, very possibly that people could use marijuana, but it's an addictive personality. And those are people that have those demons, and they have to deal with it through community help, not being made into criminals. I mean, the majority of people with substance abuse are alcoholics, obviously. I mean, in the millions and millions and millions, people in my family. I got an idea. Let's ban alcohol. Oh, no. That's right.
Oh, wait.
We tried that one. All right, thank you very much, Ed. I appreciate it. Let's see. Here's some more calls. Here is Tracy. Tracy's in Fraser. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
What up?
Well, go ahead. We got airtime going here.
Okay. The drug war is really bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure is.
Yeah, definitely.
So down with the drug war. Okay.
Okay, it's everywhere. It's distributed through residential homes.
Hey, bye-bye. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here, Tom in Dearborn Heights. Tom, thanks for joining us. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How you doing?
Good.
I just was commenting about the drug thing. I've been listening for a while. I agree with that about the biasness with the police, law enforcement agents. You know, if you want to do something, you're going to do it. That's just the way we are. I mean, whether it's legal or not, whose decision is it? It's your own. But you know.
Well, not if it's made a crime. I mean, the state has intervened in the most dramatic way.
If I want to skip a stone across the lake, I'm going to do it. If it's illegal, it's, you know, I'm going to do it anyway. But you know, if a law enforcement, I grew up in a home with my father was a police officer, so, you know, it's kind of like I understand where he's coming from,
mm-hmm.
but
yeah.
at the same time, I've experimented with drugs. I'm not an abuser.
Yeah.
Alcohol, I've done plenty of that. It's legal, so hey, you know, I do what I got to do.
Let's party!
So what are you going to do if you legalize drugs? What are you going to put 21 lines down for your kid's birthday? I mean,
yeah, I don't think so.
You know what I mean? It's far-fetched. You know, I agree with you wholeheartedly that there should be, you know, it's your choice. You're going to do it anyway. Who's to say you can do this and you can't do that? But, you know, I've got a 10-month-old daughter. I was listening to another show a couple days ago, and there was a caller, and he made a comment about drinking, and he said, you know, I'm Italian. We drink a lot, and I've been drinking since I was 12 years old, and it's not a big deal. We don't have social problems because of it. We don't have domestic problems because of it. Here, you can't drink. You know, I don't know if you caught the thing about the Tiger game where the gentleman bought his son a lemonade, and it was a Mike's Hard lemonade.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-oh.
You know, lost his kid for a week to social services. He was, you know, I mean, come on. You know? I don't know. I just think, what do you think about that? I mean, you know, do you legalize alcohol, and then you say you got to be 21, and if you're not, you're in trouble. And
well, there are these social restrictions.
My dad used to let me drink out of his beer when I was little.
I don't know when the laws came in. I mean, there wasn't always a legal drinking age, for instance. And drugs weren't always illegal.
Well, there's a lot of countries who don't have a legal drinking age.
Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I think you can drink, maybe it's just lower.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, certainly before that, if you were 15 years old and you walked into a bar and said, give me a shot of whiskey, they'd say, get out of here, kid.
I was in the bars with my braces at 16. My sister's with a fake ID. My sister's name on it.
Oh, my God.
I know. Well, it was a long time ago.
All right.
The statute of limitations is up.
Yeah, but the point being is that that so many people, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people, when you start going back 30, 40, 50 years, have had illegal experiences with intoxicants.
Right.
Drinking underage.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
I actually got busted for possession of beer when I was 20 and a half.
Oh, minor in possession?
Yeah. I mean,
I
had like 6 months to go, and I can't remember what happened. It's not on my record, I don't think. When I run for senator, we'll see it all come up.
Right.
But that is insane. Yeah. Here's Al in Ferndale. Al, hi. It's Peter and Jalene.
Hey, good morning, Jalene. Peter.
Hi.
Hey, Al.
How are you?
Good.
Hey, listen, I got a couple things here. One for Social Security.
Uh-huh.
Jalene can kind of vouch on this one. I'm that Vietnam vet. I live on a $900 a month, right? And I'm 57, 5 years to retire, and I've had like 19 operations, and I filed for Social Security disability 3 years ago and it's still in the making. The economy, I had my own little business and went down the hill.
Yeah.
Now I'm really hurting. And I can't even get out to the VA to get what I need done because of gas prices.
Wow, yeah. We don't think about little things like that.
You know what? It really hurts a lot. And, you know, Jalene can vouch on this. And, you know, I've been out there. And I'm trying to get this disability. I have a lawyer. In 5 years, I'm going to retire, you know.
Uh-huh.
But
we don't take care of our people, Al. I mean, that's pretty clear. We talk about, you know, family values. We don't take care of our families. We talk about respect for the military. We don't take care of our vets. I mean, it's just a big bunch of hypocrisy. The only people that get taken care of are the wealthy. I mean, sometimes the middle class can do okay, But at some level, we all start to scramble, and we're in one of those periods now where everybody is starting to scramble. Everybody's starting to look over their shoulder. Everybody's looking at the money flying out of their wallets, and you can see where it's all going. It's all going somewhere. And believe it. I mean, there are still, I mean, I looked through these sections of the New York Times, and the opulence, the wealth, the excessive amounts of cash available for the baubles and the art. And
did you see the $3 billion house or something like that?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I just saw there was a painting by Francis Bacon, who the one from painter from the 20th century, not the guy from 300-400 years ago, and he had some painting, I'm trying to remember, but it originally sold for like $1.5 million. I mean, here's like oil on canvas and selling for $1.5 million. Now they're expecting it in this auction tomorrow to go for $21 million.
Whoa.
Someone's gonna buy a painting for $21 million.
Can you imagine?
And Al, a Vietnam vet, is trying to get disability, is it?
Yeah,
and can't. Al, keep us informed and good luck on it. All right, man, it just
I know.
I'm going to tell you how mad that makes me.
I know.
Yeah. Here's Gary. Gary's in Fenton. Gary, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good.
I want to touch on a couple of points about this drugs. Well, first of all, about legalizing drugs. There are different varieties of drugs which are more and less addicting. Now, as for alcohol, marijuana, I think marijuana is less addicting than alcohol is. But the problem with marijuana is you are not just choosing for yourself. If you're smoking it outside or inside, somebody else can also be getting high.
You mean I haven't thought about it. I mean, if you're doing secondhand smoke, that's right. They used to call it a contact high.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so this would be. All right, so hey, I'm all for no smoking in public, period. So
Now, for other drugs. With alcohol, we have a form of testing of how much is a safe level to be operating a vehicle or out in public. With even with marijuana or anything else, we do not have any way of testing or set standards throughout how many ever years we've done this to be able to legalize this stuff today and say, okay, you can do it.
And you couldn't tell whether, like, if you pulled somebody over, you couldn't tell whether they're, I mean, you can do a blood test or a urine test, but you couldn't do it right away, like, blowing to see what your alcohol rate was. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's all sorts of problems with legalization, but to me, they just pale before what the harm, the intense, immense social harm that the drug laws have. So that's interesting, though. Like, what's the legal limit for driving under crack cocaine? I don't know.
I mean, yeah.
I hear you. All right, thank you very much. I'm going to go through these calls a little quicker because we're getting towards the end of our show. Here's John. John's in Southfield. John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I see two major issues with legalizing marijuana. Not that I'm opposed to it, but one is taxing it. You have alcohol that's taxed and tobacco that's taxed. You have to find some efficient way of taxing it because you know, the dealers are going to sell it, and they're not going to get taxed because they'll still be underground. You'll have to have going through CVS or something like that to tax it.
Or
the
maybe.
Other issue, is, like the other caller touched on, is a form of testing. You don't want someone driving around stoned. You know, you have, if they get pulled over, you have to figure out some way to test them.
Well, I wonder what they do now, because there's obviously a lot of people driving after they've smoked marijuana right now, right?
Oh, I'm sure.
But I've never heard of anyone being arrested for DUI marijuana. Have you? I never heard.
No, I've never heard of that.
Huh.
And that's a major issue with driving around stoned is that, you know, you may be able to focus, but you're still not going to be 100%.
Well, I know someone who got a DUI recently and didn't have pot or paraphernalia or anything, but he gets drug tested. I think it's because he has long hair.
Kind of
looks like Jesus.
Yeah. I mean, I thought stoners would go like 18 miles an hour. And you're like, wow, man, you know, that kind of stuff, you know. Maybe.
Maybe, I don't know.
Mike in East Point, hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hey. Hi, Mike, you're on the air.
Oh, okay. How you doing tonight?
We're doing good.
I really liked your show. I want to start off and say that.
Well, thank you, Mike.
Thanks.
Oh, okay. Well, about a month ago, me and my girlfriend, we're not
regular pot users. You know, we used to, you know, a long time ago, but, you know, we decided to...
clean your act up!
No, the other way.
Oh.
Oh, we decided to, you know, get some pot, you know, stay home and watch some movies and laugh, you know, and not bother nobody.
Right.
The police knocked on my door because of an argument the previous day and I had with a neighbor. I don't know why they showed up on the following day.
Uh-oh.
But anyways, when I live in an apartment building, okay, so I have an outside entrance, and then I have my personal entrance.
Okay.
And that's what they knocked on. So I said, who is it? And if somebody knocks on that door, I naturally think it's somebody in my building. So I went and opened the door, and right away they just pushed me aside.
Can they do that?
That's why I wanted to talk, maybe get some advice. I'm desperate here.
Well,
they're trying to charge me.
Well,
they're trying to charge me with running a drug house.
Oh no.
Distributing, and I had no paraphernalia in here at all.
Well, here's what you need to do. Unfortunately, is you need some legal representation, and it's not a matter of advice from me, because any advice beyond what I just said is not worth anything. And lawyers cost a lot of money, particularly in drug cases. They're not very apt to take cases pro bono, which means for free. If you're indigent or relatively not highly waged, sometimes there'll be public defenders, but there's probably income limits on that. But, I mean, this is a key example of what I'm talking about, how people get screwed. Because what are you going to do? I mean, you have to fight it. It's very possible that, I have no idea the facts of the case, and I always just accept what people are saying on the face of it. It doesn't really matter. I'll accept for sake of argument what you're saying. But this is the kind of problem that's attendant with laws like this. So you got to get yourself a lawyer, and if it's a financial problem, about the best you can do is look for a public defender. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Good luck on it for sure. Here's Paul in Brighton. Paul, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Long time no talk to.
Hi, you're on the air. Hi, yeah.
I've been riding myself. You've been riding?
Oh.
Saving a little bit of the earth, you know.
Bicycles.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that'd be neat.
Well,
you know, when did we ever stick to the oil standard? All of a sudden we are worried about how we're going to live the next day until we find out what the gas price is going to be for the next time we got to drive. This has gone insane. Now, for the drug people, now Anslinger is the whole problem with this whole thing, because he lied to everybody. Marijuana is not the drug to be worried about. See, people...
should tell people. We're talking about Harry Anslinger, who was the first drug czar back in the 1930s, and who was kind of a whack job, just like J. Edgar Hoover.
Yeah, he lied to everybody.
Congress, yeah.
Yeah, he lied to Congress. He lied to everybody. So, you know, and everybody who ends up, they say that it's like the stepping stone. It's not the stepping stone. It's people that you're around. They don't tell you that you can die if this is not cut right. 45% of cocaine, if it's not cut less than that, it'll kill you. And they don't tell you that. See, your friends are not your friends. Someone tells you that cocaine or heroin is not going to do nothing to you, they lied.
Well, it certainly is probably a drug that ought to be approached with great trepidation, to say the least.
Right. Well, and what the problem with heroin now is this, they're mixing it with this fentanyl, and people are dying.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Paul, I got to get a call. Last one in before we end our show. It's Scott in Birmingham. Scott, you got about 60 seconds, so give me your idea to legalize marijuana.
The idea is we pass a law requiring everybody in the government, police officers, judges, politicians, governors, presidents, to be tested randomly and regularly. Most people who work for a corporation or a company have to be tested. Why should our politicians not be?
I agree. There you go. They would probably end the laws immediately, right? Yeah.
We hope.
All right. Yeah. Thank you very much. Thanks for being our last caller on Night Call. And thanks to all of you for listening and for calling. And it ain't over yet. Coming up after our commercials, Mark Juergensmeyer, who's written Global Rebellion, Religious Challenge to the Secular State. Also Stan Cox, author of Sick Planet, Corporate Food and Medicine. Jalene Jordan, thank you so much.
Thank
Al Slayer.
You,
hey, and he's going to be rocking at 2 a.m.
Thank you, Al.
All right. Talk next week.
This is WRIM.com. 101 WRIM will keep you rocking with Kid Rock all summer long. Keep it locked on the Riff all this week. Listen for the Kid Rock montage for your chance to beat the box office with tickets to see Kid Rock and his expanded 11-piece Twisted Brown Trucker Band featuring special guest Rev Run of the legendary Run DMC and surprise special guest at DTE Energy Music Theater Saturday, July 19th and Sunday, July 20th. That's right. The Riff is hooking you up with tickets to both shows. Tickets go on sale Saturday, May 3rd at 10 a.m. Keep here for your chance to win from the station that keeps you rocking all summer long.
What's happening? This is Kid Rock. You're listening to 101. Slap her.
As 101 WRIF and Bud Light presents the finals of the 2008 Riff Rock Girl Search, featuring the return of Filter. With special guest Red. Vote for your favorite Riff Rock Girl contestants now at WRIF.com. Then, see the final four contestants at the Royal Oak Music Theater as the next Riff Rock Girl is chosen. Doors open at 7 p.m. All ages welcome. Tickets for WRIF's 2008 Riff Rock Girl Finals featuring Filter are on sale right now. Get them at the Royal Oak Music Theater box office at alltickets.com outlets, online at tickets.com, aeglive.com, or charge at 800-919-6272. WRIF's 2008 Riff Rock Girl Finals featuring Filter live in concert Friday, May 16th. Brought to you by Bud Light. Bud Light keeps it coming at 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Peter Werby here. Thank you so much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. War, terror, guerrilla attacks, suicide bombing, suddenly that's just become part of our landscape, something we take for granted. It wasn't always with us. Certainly wars and problems and guerrilla groups and all that have been around for quite a while. But suddenly there's a global rebellion, and that's the name of a brand new book from the University of California Press. It's Global Rebellion, Religious Challenges to the Secular State from Christian Militias to Al-Qaeda. The author is Mark Juergensmeyer, and he is professor of sociology and director of global and international studies at the University of California at Santa Barbara. And normally I wouldn't mention all the books, but I think the titles are relevant here. Terror in the Mind of God. He's the editor of Global Religions, an Introduction. Also the author of The New Cold War, Religious Nationalism Confronts the Secular State. And also Gandhi's Way, a handbook of conflict resolution. That at least there's some way out here. Joining me from Santa Barbara, Mark Juergensmeyer. Thank you so much for being on the broadcast.
My pleasure.
Now, actually, in the, well, I think it's even on the leaf of the jacket. It is. It says, why has the turn of the 21st century been rocked by a new religious rebellion? I mean, that's the whole book, but is there a simple way to summarize that?
Yeah, I think so. But let me tell you how I tried to get into this in the first place. I mean, I was faced with those two fundamental questions when you that I think occur in most people's minds when you look at this kind of rise of religious rebellions around the world. Why is this happening now, and what does religion have to do with it?
Sure.
And so in order to try to answer that question, I went out and talked with people. I went out and talked with people who were directly involved in acts of violence, people whom we might call terrorists, people associated with Al-Qaeda who were involved in the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, members of Hamas, including the leaders Sheikh Yassin and Dr. Rantisi, members of the Christian militia, Christian activists involved in abortion clinic bombings, even people involved in the unleashing of the nerve gas in Tokyo associated with a radical Buddhist sect. So what I found was that there are forms of religious extremism touched with violence directed against the secular state in every religious tradition in every part of the world.
Hmm. And you know, what struck me in your opening comments were there was two levels. One, you spoke to the leadership, and two, to the foot soldiers. Is there a difference in the type of personality that you saw? I mean, any generalized observation?
Yeah, probably a difference in the personality, but not a lot of difference in the ideology. And what I was interested in was not so much the psychology of terrorism, why particular people are drawn into it, because it struck me from the outset that all kinds of people are drawn into it. It's the ideology, the culture.
But if we look at the pronouncements of Osama bin Laden, certainly he thinks of himself as defending the Muslim world, as he says, against the Crusaders and the Jews. But you know, there's an old saying that if you kill women and children and you have a uniform on, you're a soldier. If you kill women and children and you're in civilian clothes, you're a terrorist. So are these men actually soldiers in the same sense?
Well, they certainly think of themselves as soldiers. Let me give you an example. I had several interviews with Mahmoud Abu Lima, who was involved in the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, a follower of the blind sheikh, but indirectly, of course, a part of the wider jihadi network that we associated with Al-Qaeda. And by the way, I don't think there's any one Al-Qaeda. There are a lot of movements that are more or less loosely affiliated, and the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993, which would have been much worse, by the way, if they had brought it than happened in 9/11, if they brought the whole thing down immediately and it fell into the adjacent buildings, hundreds of thousands of people would be killed. But Abu Lima, the fellow I talked with, refused to be described as a terrorist. He regarded himself as a soldier for God. He regarded himself on a religious mission, although he wasn't a particularly pious person. He was not, he felt that he had a duty. He was kind of defending his people. Yeah, he had a lot of braggadocio. He's a pretty self-confident guy, maybe arrogant, but and maybe even self-righteous, but not. I don't think anyone would describe him as pathologically evil, although he's been involved in some horrific acts, implicated with possibly in the assassination of Sadat, the killing of rival mullahs in Brooklyn, involved in the Afghanistan Mujahideen, and then, implicated in the killing of Meir Kahane, the Jewish rabbi who was anti-Arab. And then involved in the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. So a whole trail of blood behind him, and yet, to listen to him talking about the calm that Islam brought to his life, the kind of center, and looking on me as somebody he regarded as a secularist who somehow our lives were lessened, were cheaper, without this kind of anchor that he felt that Islam had brought to him. You couldn't listen to him without maybe being fooled. You know, I'm not pretending that he wasn't putting on a performance for my sake. I think he was, but still, it was an artful performance, and it was certainly not a simple character, and these are not people who can be easily dismissed.
I assume you spoke to him in prison.
Yeah.
Yeah, and why do you think he spoke to you?
Well, it's an interesting case. It took a couple years for me to actually work out the interviews. His lawyer didn't want him to talk with me because he was still hoping to get out on appeal. I think Abu Lima wanted to get his message out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, after all, you know, when I talked to him about why people bomb buildings, and he said, we want to send a message, Mr. Mark. He said, we want to tell you that the government is the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Then he looked at me and smiled, and he said, and now you know.
I just want to go back to something that I said before. I mean, if it might have been shocking to people that I was suggesting an equivalency between our armed forces or any armed forces in the world and people that carry out these terrorist attacks. In wars now, civilians are generally 80% of the victims, which include women and children. And everyone has a rationale for why civilians had to die. I guess here we call it, in this country, we call it collateral damage. It doesn't alter the equation in my mind, though. The book is...
Sure, but for most of us, we see military action as authorized by a government that presumably has not only our best interest, but in the best interest of the world at heart, who are doing this for acts that are justified in terms of trying to release violence. So we make peace with what we regard as the necessity of warfare, but we see people like Abu Lima as, you know, kind of on the murky edges of social order. And yet, you're absolutely right. From their point of view, they're the real soldiers. They are the ones upholding peace. They are the ones upholding moral order. So I think you put your finger on something very important, which to me is a clue to why all of this is happening. And that it's a struggle for moral order,
mm-hmm.
a sense that there's something about the contemporary world, a world of rapid social change, a world of globalization, that's simply unstable. And people, especially in diaspora communities, people who are outside of their traditional cultures, or people who are part of a national community that's not easily defined, like Palestinians, which there's a controversy, they would feel this kind of sense of almost personal frustration and being out of place, for which being in an army, being a soldier, being able to fight for a cause gives a location, gives a purpose, gives meaning, and allows you to fight for something that's not only righteous politically, but is just morally and in tune with your religious sensibilities.
Well, Mark Juergensmeyer, your book, Global Rebellion, has at least the first part of the subtitle, Religious Challenges to the Secular State. The secular state was ushered in a few hundred years ago, most notably in this country with the U.S. Constitution. Why now is it under, as you say, this religious challenge? Why hasn't religion been swept away as obscurantism, something belonging back before modernity?
Well, I don't think religion ever disappeared. I mean, the Enlightenment tried very much to put religion in its box, you know, kind of carefully say, Sunday morning, you want to go to this religious club, that's fine with us, as long as you don't allow it to mess up the rest of our public lives. But religion has always, in a sense, messed up the rest of our public lives, and it's kind of a haunting evocation of a different kind of world, a different kind of reality. And at its best, it can be the moral force behind a change of laws, like during the Civil Rights era, where the church was very much involved in to try to make the society a better place. It had a higher moral vision. So religion has always been at the edge of public life to play a prophetic role. But then why does it come on so stridently in so many different places, including the United States? It could have been far more acts of Christian terrorism undertaken on American soil than Muslim terrorism, far more.
Yeah, very, very
few. Forget the Oklahoma City Federal Building. It really was an attack undertaken for a religious purpose. If you look at Timothy McVeigh's ideology, and the Turner Diaries is full of this kind of religious idea that he's trying to make the world better for a Christian society. And that's that was the dominant form of terrorism before a couple, of course, spectacularly successful acts like 9/11 made us think that Muslim terrorism was more of a threat than Christian terrorism. But there have been these critiques in every religious tradition, I think, because globalization is a global phenomenon. That is, throughout the world, the nation state as a kind of secure entity is under assault. It's changing. Economically, you know, our economy is hopelessly tied in with China, with other parts of the world. Militarily, most parts of the world, except for the United States, do not have significant armies. Currency, you know, a national currency is a kind of joke. We use plastic. We use some other kind of international. The point is that the people can live anywhere and do. The mobilization of people, the easy access to culture, where images of modernity based on where I live in Southern California projected around the world. There are more people in the Middle East watching the serial Friends than watch Al Jazeera TV. You know, we're afraid of Al Jazeera's TV. This is supposed to be shaping the minds of the Muslim world. They're watching Friends. You know, they're getting their cultural cues from images that are, projected out of Southern California. Well, what a world we live in. It's easy to understand, I mean, in our personal lives, how we feel kind of marginal to this kind of rapid social change. You can see how people in traditional societies or societies that are otherwise politically in flux can feel this even more keenly, and how guys especially, men, take this on personally as a feeling of shame, of humiliation, of somehow not being able to control their lives and see religion as a rudder, as an anchor for identity, for moral accountability, and a social storm.
Well, there's lots of threads, I'm sure, that motivate people on an individual level, but part of it is this invasion of Western culture that is routinely described as corrupt and opposed to the religious tenets of...
Yeah, the Ayatollah Khomeini talked about West toxification, being inebriated with things Western. That was one of his driving calls during the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979.
Yeah, which is not very different from religious conservatives anywhere, including this country.
Yep.
Yeah, if we look at the statements of some of, I can't remember exactly who said what, but about New Orleans recently, I'm forgetting the man's name who was associated with John McCain, or the ones, either Robertson or the other, who said after 9/11 it was God's punishment because of the lesbians, and
right.
Who never knew they had that much power.
Those darn lesbians. You know?
Yeah.
Yes, but that's true. There's a sense that moral laxity can lead to a kind of letdown in the social fabric in general, that weakens a nation, it weakens a people, and you can say, well, you know, who cares? But some people do care. They feel that their world is kind of being eroded out from underneath them, and they experience this very troubling. I talk with a number of people, including people associated with Christian extremist movements, who described a kind of aha experience when they first accepted the kind of warlike ideology, that there's a great battle, this great invisible war that we can't see, but a great battle between good and evil and right and wrong. You know, all of the activists in 9/11, the people who had hijacked the planes, thought of themselves as being involved in a great invisible war and having the opportunity to finally let the world know about this war that they had perceived in their imaginations all the time. And now suddenly this extraordinary act, this devastating experience at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon made the world aware of this war that was going on in their lives. And for some people, as I said, it was an aha experience to be able to see the world in these terms and how satisfying that was, to suddenly understand why the world is going wrong the way it was going wrong. It's because of them evildoers. There were evil people in the world. You know, that's just the radical religious perspective, that there are evildoers. The jihadi's perspective is that there are evildoers, and it's a world of black and white and right and wrong and religion and irreligion, and they can enter this battle and make a difference.
Global Rebellion is the book. The subtitle, Religious Challenges to the Secular State from Christian Militias to Al-Qaeda. Mark Juergensmeyer is my guest. You can go to ucpress.edu. It'll also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. I'll give that at the end of our talk as well. Certainly what we saw on 9/11 and what we've seen as a result of terrorist acts everywhere from, the IRA to Israel and Sri Lanka and all the...
And Iraq. 60% of the terrorist activities this last year came out of Iraq.
Okay. These are major threats to public security and ought to be addressed in that manner. But when some of the conservative commentators talk about this is the main struggle of this era, that they want to set up this world caliphate, is that a realistic possibility?
No. The numbers of people directly involved with the jihadi network, I estimated in this book, as being, at the time of 9/11, probably in the hundreds, maybe in the thousands, but not much. It depends, of course, on what you mean. There were a larger number of sympathizers and people who kind of shared the ideology. But in terms of being actually connected with an operational activities, really fall a very small number. And their ability to create shocking images is pretty great. I mean, you don't need a lot of people or even a lot of money. You just need kind of the crazy idea and determination to go with it, and people who are willing to give their lives in order to undertake these acts. And you can, with a handful of people, put on a pretty nasty show.
Sure.
But then what? It's not like Osama bin Laden has a standing army. It doesn't even have a vision or an image of a national government. No plans. There's no scenario about how he's going to set up even a national, much less an international or transnational force. There are these funny, fuzzy ideas of kind of a global caliphate of a new Ottoman Empire. You heard it in his speeches. From the cave right after 9/11, when he was talking about it's been 80 years since the West has dominated the Middle East and it's time to reverse that. Well, that he's talking about the end of the Ottoman Empire and the end of the caliphate, and now is an opportunity to create a new one. Boy, bin Laden would love to be the new caliph. I mean, the megalomania of the guy is just unbelievable. He would love to be that new caliph, but, fortunately, the Muslim world doesn't pay him that much attention. His popularity spiked only because of us, because we responded, that is, the United States responded with such ferocity and in such devastating ways, first in Afghanistan and then, of course, in Iraq, in such a way that inadvertently, I assume inadvertently, heightened his popularity among kind of marginal people and people, disaffected people around the world, and kind of vaulted him into a position of being the leader of the oppressed and the resentful around the Muslim world. We did that. We were the biggest publicity agent that bin Laden could ever ask for. But that's not an enduring. That's not a network. That's not an organization. That's not anything to be ultimately afraid of. We can be afraid of the chaos, that is, the unraveling of social order and the kind of dissent that these acts of religious rebellion point to. That should be our concern rather than the networks themselves, although obviously security is important to everybody. We should be vigilant. We should have surveillance, but not assume that they really have the power to make any kind of difference in the world.
Well, the damage that can be done to a country, I mean, Israel is one example of it, even with high security and incredible surveillance, that if you, as you said, if you have the will among people, and the people, I don't even, it may even be the name of a title of a Mike Davis essay that says car bomb as the poor man's F-14. So that as long as there's a feeling on a part of a people of oppression or of conflict, this is going to continue. What resolves this? I mean, Osama bin Laden hasn't said it as that he demands a world caliphate to end everything. He says essentially the West, as you just indicated, has to get out of the Middle East. I mean, I always wonder, what in the hell are we doing in the Middle? I mean, I know what it's all about. I mean, what if we just said, you know, we've been mucking around in these people's affairs, exploiting them since the 1880s and even some before. Why don't we just all go home? Would that unravel this religious rebellion against the West?
Oh yeah, I think it would make a difference. I mean, a change of our policies would make a huge difference in undercutting the kind of support that extremists like Bin Laden feed on. I don't think we're ever going to change the heart of Bin Laden, and probably shouldn't even try. But you could certainly affect the kind of general popular support that buoys his popularity and makes him feel like he's much more important than he is. And the America's political presence in the Middle East and the perception that America supports Israel over Palestine, the perception that America wants to take over countries like Iraq in order to keep down Muslim governments. You know, I was in Iraq for this book. There are interviews that I have with mullahs in Iraq, where in the book that you talk about, where I'm trying to understand the Islamicization of the insurgency. I mean, you can understand why people would be resentful over an occupation, but you know, at one point, one of the mullahs told me, he says, you know, you Americans will not succeed in Iraq because Islam will prevail.
Hmm.
And that struck me as being remarkable, that he would think that the whole reason for the American presence in Iraq was simply to be against Islam, not against Saddam, not against dictatorship, but against Islam. And I tried to argue with him, and he just brushed away my arguments. And he said, you know, we know that the America has propped up Saddam all these years. You're not really against Saddam, you because he was your secular secular puppet. What we realized is you had to get rid of Saddam and rule directly because you were afraid of the coming Islamic revolution, and now we have a chance to prevail.
Oh.
What an extraordinary image, and it was all fueled by the idea that America's meddling had a cultural reason and not just a political or even an economic, like oil. So it seems to me inadvertently, we've found ourselves in a much deeper mess than even we had thought by activities which seem to be justified for other calculations, moral or economic, political or economic. So I think you're right. A change of American policies would make a huge difference, and particularly peace in the Middle East and Palestine and Israel would have an enormous impact throughout the region and undercut these kind of more extremist fantasies that fuel people like Osama bin Laden.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Again, the book is Global Rebellion, Religious Challenges to the Secular State, from Christian Militias to Al-Qaeda. The author is Mark Juergensmeyer. You can go to ucpress.edu, or you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. Risa Aslan, who is the author of No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and the Future of Islam, says, Juergensmeyer remains our best guide in unraveling the complex interplay between religion and politics in the modern world. Global Rebellion once again demonstrates why Juergensmeyer is the foremost authority on the global sociology of religion. This is an awe-inspiring work by arguably the most important thinker on the subject. You don't get a better endorsement than that, do you?
No, I appreciate it.
Yes, and I appreciate you taking the time to be with us on the Peter Werbe Show. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
WRIF.com. When you're ahead of the digital curve, sometimes you have to toot your own horn. Proudly streaming worldwide since 1997 at WRIF.com. And now you can also hear our HD2 sister station.
What's the name of this place?
RIF2 at RIF2.com. Everything that rocks.
www.WRIF.com.
101 WRIF will keep you rocking with Kid Rock all summer long. Keep it locked on the Riff all this week. Listen for the Kid Rock montage for your chance to beat the box office with tickets to see Kid Rock and his expanded 11-piece twisted brown trucker band featuring special guest Rev Run of the legendary Run. Friday, May 16th at the Royal Oak Music Theater. It's a party you won't soon forget as 101 WRIF and Bud Light presents the finals of the 2008 Riff Rock Girl Search, featuring the return of Future. With special guest, Red. Vote for your favorite Riff Rock Girl contestants now at WRIF.com. Then, see the final four contestants at the Royal Oak Music Theater as the next Riff Rock Girl is chosen. Doors open at 7 p.m. All ages welcome. Tickets for WRIF's 2008 Riff Rock Girl Finals featuring Filter are on sale right now. Get them at the Royal Oak Music Theater box office at all tickets.com outlets, online at tickets.com, AEGLive.com, or charge at 800-919-6272. WRIF's 2008 Riff Rock Girl Finals featuring Filter live in concert Friday, May 16th. Brought to you by Bud Light. Bud Light keeps it coming at 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Peter Werby here with you. Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you and to talk about one of the big problems. One of the many problems or the many problems facing our planet. In fact, a sick planet. And I'll make that clear why I'm calling it a sick planet in just a second. So much of what we're facing has cascaded down upon us just recently. The energy crisis, the food crisis, the financial crisis. Well, joining me is someone who has written a book called Sick Planet, Corporate Food and Medicine. His name is Stan Cox, and he's a senior scientist at the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas. He's worked for the U.S. Department of Agriculture from 1984 to 1996, and he has a doctorate in plant genetics from way out in the Midwest. It's a pleasure to bring to our microphones on the Peter Werby Show, Stan Cox. Welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you, Peter. Good to be with you.
Now, I think maybe right off the bat, what I found about this book compelling, you have a very kind of conventional description here. A senior scientist, you work for the USDA, and yet this book is very radical. Radical in the sense of going to the root and probably some solutions that people might find, an analysis that people might find extreme. Is there a big transformation in Stan Cox from mainstream to critic on the sidelines?
Not really, Peter. I've been working for a couple of decades in agricultural science, which is about as conventional as you can get. I saw from even back in the 80s that the solutions that we were trying to come up with in a technical sense in the field and in the laboratory weren't ever going to get us anywhere unless there was a bigger change in the overall society and the economy. And so I started studying that in my spare time and writing for web publications, things like that, and realized that each of the individual problems that I was writing about really were all facets of the same big problem, which is the economic system that we're trying to deal with and to squeeze into an earth that isn't big enough for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you certainly, working for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, you went through the Reagan administration, the Bush 1 administration, and the Clinton administration. So that puts you in pretty much of a mainstream setting.
And I spent several years in India during that time as well, and to kind of see the other side of consumption in this country.
Mm-hmm. I hear in your voice the accent of you, if you will, of a son of the Midwest. Do you have a direct connection with farming, or was it mostly just academic studies?
Well, actually, I grew up in Georgia and came to the Midwest on my 21st birthday, and have been here since then. But I grew up in a town of 30,000 or so didn't grow up on a farm.
Mm-hmm. Well, so much for me spotting regional accents. But
well, I've been away a long time, and I probably watched too much TV when I was a kid. And
there you go. Well, tell us about Sick Planet, corporate food and medicine. We depend on corporations for our food. We depend on corporations for our medicine, yet we see increasing signs of a sick planet to the point where it's getting pretty frightening. Well, explain the main thesis of your book.
Well, we have a almost religious belief that that guides our economy and society, that the invisible hand of the market is going to be always the best way to and most efficient way to allocate resources and make sure everybody has what he or she needs. And it, despite the fact that there have been repeated spectacular failures of that market to do that, we're still trying to run things that way. And I wanted to look at a couple of areas of our lives that involve really fundamental necessities, obviously nutrition and the ability to stay healthy. And we've got very dysfunctional systems in both of those areas. In healthcare, for example, it's managing to accomplish a pretty amazing feat of depriving millions of people of health care they need, while at the same time producing excessive quantities of health care for even more people. We're now 16% of our economy is health care. We, from 2001 to 2006, 1.7 million jobs were created in the healthcare field. In the rest of the economy put together, the net number of jobs created in those 6 years was exactly zero. So pretty much the entire job growth of that period, and it's probably still going that way, was in an industry that is supposed to be keeping people healthy when it's largely doing the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Well, you would think that if we expend so much on medical care on one hand, and of course, as you indicated, denying many people the full benefits of what's available, we must be a pretty sick nation. Your book is Sick Planet, but if we have to spend that much money and that much resources and corporate profits are so high because of illness, we're not a very healthy society.
Right. And if to stay with healthcare a minute, right, one, the industry would actually have it that we all, virtually all of us, are sick. I took eight diseases or eight conditions that are, and you've seen advertisements for all of these, and took the percentage that the pharmaceutical industry gives us for the number of people who suffer from these conditions: erectile dysfunction, female sexual dysfunction, sleeplessness, restless leg, bipolar, irritable bowel syndrome, etc. If you do the math and say, okay, if having one of those doesn't affect whether you have the other one, and if you believe the industry that 20% of people have this one, et cetera, that means that over 90 or 95% of Americans have at least one of those and are qualified for medical treatment.
Yeah, what do you think, though, that's inaccurate or they're overselling it? Restless leg syndrome, that's a new one. I mean, I've heard that recently, but some of these conditions obviously are of great concern. I mean, you know, so much is spent on stomach ailments and sleep deprivation and irritable bowel syndrome. I mean, a lot of that comes out of the stressful lives we lead, of course.
Yeah, but a lot of the increasing diagnoses of these are a result of the companies going through the medical manuals, finding a condition, say like restless leg, which my father has a serious case of that, and before it was ever advertised or anything, he sought out help, and the medication has helped him. But they'll go through and find restless leg or bipolar or something, and then expand the definition of it to go from, say, 0.5% of the population to saying, well, actually 20% or something have a mild form of this condition,
mm-hmm.
and need treatment, and then put those Ask Your Doctor ads on the air. If you watch the evening news on the networks at night, virtually every advertisement is for one of these prescription drugs.
Sure.
The other way people kind of get roped into the system is over-testing. The estimates in the medical journals say that if you go by medical guidelines, that 43% of the imaging tests that are done are not necessary, shouldn't have been done, 37% of the urinalysis, 32% of biopsies, etc. And that statistics show that if 100 people have multiple tests done, 40 of those people are going to be found to have a problem that they don't really have. And so then they go on from there, kind of move deeper into the medical system from there.
Well, it is. The axiom is that you are sick till proven well.
Right. And, yeah. and that has the point then of the medical chapters in the book then is that by doing that, we're not only because of side effects of drugs and so forth, but we're undermining the life support systems of the earth that help keep people healthy.
Mike, well, how does that hook together?
Well, there any ramped-up economic activity always has ecological consequences. So the average hospital bed generates somewhere between 10 and 50 pounds of waste every day. We've all been in hospitals and seen the huge amounts of plastic and so forth,
mm-hmm.
that are used.
Latex gloves, I mean, has always struck me how much they use. That's recent innovation. Yeah.
Right. And then the pharmaceutical industry, that's a fairly dirty industry. And this huge increase in the output of pharmaceuticals has, as in every other industry, led us to other countries to try to get production done cheaper, so that 40% of our bulk drug production now comes from India and China together, and it's headed, they say, for 80% of our bulk drugs. One of the chapters in there, I sort of followed that upstream to a small region in India that has 30 or 40% of India's bulk drug production, and saw the ecological consequences for destruction of their water supplies, air pollution, etc.
The book is Sick Planet, Corporate Food and Medicine. My guest is Stan Cox. He's a senior scientist at the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas. Or is it Salina? Which is
It's Salina.
Salina, okay. I'm doing the Spanish pronunciation. But I think this could lead us into the discussion about corporate food. What is the Land Institute?
We're a nonprofit research institute here. It was established in 1976. I came here in 2000. We're working on developing future farming systems that perform the ecological functions that the prairie did before the European populations came here, say, to Kansas in the mid-1800s. And plowed up the prairie to plant annual crops like wheat. We have a lot of documented problems with soil erosion, water contamination, poor health of people, all kinds of problems that have arisen largely because we're dependent on a small number of annual grain crops. Annual meaning crops that have to be planted from seed every year, meaning that we have bare soil through much of the year. We have soil with no roots in the ground, no living roots, which makes the soil kind of a dead zone for much of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's what we're working on, is developing perennial grain crops, which would be a whole new group of crop species that we believe would feed humanity without resorting to as much chemical pesticide use and without soil erosion.
Now, I know, I'm trying to think how long ago, but years and years ago, I'm trying to think, maybe even as much as 20 years ago, I interviewed a couple who was had a vision of bringing back prairie grass to those regions of the middle Midwest, including Kansas, Nebraska, places like that, and reintroducing the buffalo. Do you remember who they were? Do you know
them? Yeah, those were the poppers Rutgers University.
That's right.
And they were writing about the they referred to as the Buffalo Commons.
Oh, that's very, very good. Yeah.
And that eventually is the fate of the High Plains, whether we want it or not, because the water resources out there, the underground water that is feeding agriculture out there, is a finite resource. They're mining that water, and once it's gone, short grass prairie and buffalo populations are going to be about it.
Welcome back. Welcome back, let's say. In this idea, though, of having a sustainable wheat crop, that's good, because I thought maybe you had the popper vision, because we're all of a sudden looking at a worldwide food crisis with prices rising, production dropping. As in many ways, your book foretold that. Were you surprised to suddenly see this jump into the front page of the papers and on television?
Well, not surprised, because a lot of people working in this area have been saying that it's going to happen one of these days, and nobody knew exactly when. But I think with the passage of legislation, subsidies, et cetera, for biofuels, we pretty much ensured that the food crisis would come sooner rather than later.
Hmm. Well, I just saw in the New York Times today an article about fertilizer, chemical-based fertilizer, and how, according to this article, how critical it was to crop production, and it showed the immense rise in the use of it throughout the world. Interestingly, though, dropping in Canada and in the European Union. Everywhere else, great rise in the price of it, to the point where the fear, according to the article, was that crop production was going to drop considerably. Did any thoughts about that?
Yeah, that's chapter 6 in my book.
Okay, there you go.
This was exactly what I was talking about there. There's an amazing statistic, but a Canadian academic analyst has calculated that without chemical nitrogen fertilizer, that is using a chemical process to take nitrogen out of the air and put it into a form that we can feed crops with, if that had not been invented, 40% of humanity wouldn't be here today, and that if we suddenly lost that half the world population would not be able to survive. We've become that dependent on getting nitrogen through an industrial process that was originally designed for trying to make explosives, et cetera, but about a century ago.
Yeah, that's why those fertilizers have been used, like at the Oklahoma City explosion. That was the main basis of it. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, it... I know that in Cuba, for instance, they do 80 to 90% organic farming and gardening, and some of the people in a movie I saw recently, they said that they had crop increases where the article in the New York Times said that without it, as you said, a crop production would be much lower, that manure contains only like 10% of what these chemical fertilizers can contain per pound. So I actually got a little confused as to what's possible or what's necessary.
Yeah, there has been an analysis by one of my colleagues of the dependence of various countries on chemical nitrogen fertilizer, and it all depends on the population of the country relative to the amount of land area they have and the types of crops they're able to grow. So it ironically, the countries that use some of the largest quantities of nitrogen fertilizer, like the United States, are actually the least dependent on it. We have enough land that if we reduced meat consumption, cut exports and various things, we could grow enough leguminous crops like alfalfa and soybeans that take nitrogen out of the air themselves to provide all of our nitrogen needs and not have to use synthetic fertilizer, whereas certain other countries, Egypt, Bangladesh, some other countries, their very existence depends on having nitrogen fertilizer.
Hmm.
And so when I would go around India, you would see farmers with a pan and literally taking handfuls of this very expensive fertilizer and throwing it around onto the rice paddy to get just enough to get the crop through. They're chronically short there. Whereas here, we put on huge amounts, say on a crop of corn, you have to put on twice as much fertilizer as the crop can actually use just to get it through, to get the yield that farmers are after.
Mm-hmm. Sick Planet is the book. Corporate Food and Medicine. Stan Cox is my guest, the author. It's published by Pluto Press. You can go to Pluto, like the planet, PlutoBooks.com. There will also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. I'll give that information just in a few minutes. When I mentioned at the beginning of Sick Planet, your book, Stan Cox, being radical both in the sense of getting to the root, that's appropriate when we're talking about growing food, but also in terms of its analysis and what you propose. And I just keep getting worried about the passenger pigeon syndrome for the world's population, that there could be just this crash of if all these things, the perfect storm came together. What's it going to take? Someone asked me, in fact, it was at a showing of this film about Cuba's organic food production, and they said to me, what's it going to take to wake the American people up? Without thinking, I said, catastrophe. And and everybody kind of looked appalled. What do you think? What's going to be the alarm bell that's going to make us wake up?
You wonder. At this point, people have what it is going to take, because I think now you don't have to work nearly as hard as you would have had to work 10 or even 5 years ago to convince people that there is ecological catastrophe looming. Strangely enough, I am more of the mind of the your sort of old school executive or capitalist who says, well, look, we can't any cutback we do or any effort to try to decrease our impact on the planet is going to hurt our bottom line. We're just not going to be able to do it. They've examine the situation, and that's probably a good assessment. I'm much more wary of so-called green capitalists who claim you can have it all. You can have big economic growth, loads of consumer goods, and not have economic or not have ecological impact. It it defies logic and theory that's been built up in ecological economics over decades now.
Mm-hmm. If we went to the Land Institute, well, I'm sorry, if we went to sickplanetbook.com, will that link us up with the Land Institute?
Let's see. There's not a link to the Land Institute on that site, but it's just landinstitute.org is the Land Institute's website.
And I think sometimes what makes people uncomfortable about a show and a discussion like this, they wonder, what can I do tomorrow to address this problem? I mean, you're working at the Land Institute in Salina, but is there something that the average citizen can do?
Well, probably to stay home from the store and go on a consumption strike is one thing, we need, obviously, a more organized approach to it. But there are a lot of good examples out there of community-supported agriculture programs, co-ops, natural health programs, and so forth. But there needs to be a much wider agreement that we have to figure out a way to have an improved life without the kind of growth that we hear every day on the economic news that we have to have. That those things are no longer on a full planet that we have now. Those things are no longer compatible.
No, I think we're going to have to leave it at that because we're out of time with Stan Cox. And here's the information. We've got to make some decisions about what we're going to do as individuals and also, more importantly, what we're going to do as a country and as a culture. The book is Sick Planet, Corporate Food and Medicine. It's published by Pluto Press. You can go to sickplanetbook.com. Thank you so much. Oh, and there'll be a link on my site as well. Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. Stan Cox, thanks for joining me on the broadcast.
Thank you, Peter.
This is WRIM.com. Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIM. Everything that rocks.
It's so-
Washington, WRIF.com.
Grandpa's old radio. Oh, wouldn't it be grand to gather round and have a listen?
Well, turn something on. I'm starting to think.